ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your host, Craig
and Matt
Allen.
And just like that, we're back and live with Fight Night Picks, as always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. Twitter and Instagram, Craig Allen FNP, with me to my left, to your right. As always, respective socials, Matt Allen, FNP. It was a week away for Fight Night Picks. We had some time to digest the happenings with UFC Fight Night Dern versus Zhao Nan. And coming up this weekend, another main event that people might not be able to rally around up until about Saturday. But we have Alexa Grasso taking on Viviane Araújo. And if you look at both of these Fight Night main events, a lot of similarities. Different divisions, strawweight a couple of weeks ago, this weekend at flyweight, but you have your fifth-ranked fighter in Grasso taking on your sixth-ranked fighter out of Brazil in Araújo. And you look at the top half of this division, a little stale. Chookagian, never the bride, always the bridesmaid.
Just the forever number one contender right now.
Exactly. So Valentina Shevchenko needs a new challenger. Realistically, this would be a fresh matchup should one of these women win impressively. But that's not the Fight Night Pick spin on this entire card. Because look at this. There are some really, really tricky fights on this card. You have a 2022 UFC Hall of Famer competing in the co-main event. You have top-ranked men's flyweights that, listen, if you look at it, could they fight for a rematch with Pantoja? Maybe. Could they fight for a rematch with Kai Kara France? Maybe. They both fought those guys. But if you do look at it, probably not title implications because Pantoja is going to weigh in as an alternate to January's title fight, the fourth installment of Figueiredo versus Moreno. Number four, how wild is that? But Askarov, Brandon Royval, absolute fireworks. It is a very interesting card. It really is that Fight Night Pick special.
Rafael dos Anjos buried on the prelims of a Fight Night card. And that's the thing. We'll be honest to you guys. If the card's not great, we'll come out and say it. I actually think this card's pretty good, though. I think the main card is a really stacked portion of it. Misha Cirkunov, Alonzo Menafield's a really fun fight. I know we're both excited for that Askarov, Brandon Royval fight. If you like MMA even a little bit, you're going to love that fight. But I really do think there's a lot of fun kind of hidden gems scattered all throughout this card.
It should be a great one. We're going to kick it on over to you, so make sure you comment below. Let us know who you have in your fight in the night screen. I already tipped it off. You do have one Hall of Famer on the card. Will he feature there? Let us know in the comment section. We're throwing it on over to the fight in the night screen.
Let us know down below in the comment section who you've got. It's time for the fight of the night with Fight Night Picks.
Hey, look at that. Look at us. I mean, Cub Swanson, 10 fight of the night bonuses this time with WEC and the UFC. Taking on, you have to call me Dragon, Jonathan Martinez, a guy who's absolutely on a roll as of late. And if you look at these two guys, I mean, Cub Swanson takes a couple of losses, takes a lot of wins, takes four losses. And if you look at his last four fights, 3-1, fight of the night with Crone Gracie. His last time out, it was a performance bonus, knocking out Darren Elkins with a spinning wheel kick. Cub Swanson just won't go away. And for Jonathan Martinez, kind of a slow burn up to the top. And the real ones know. I mean, this guy is a southpaw kicking specialist. And he will kick your leg off, your arm off, your head off. This should be a very, very fun fight while it lasts.
Did Dana White let me make a fight? Because if he did, this is probably the fight I would have put together. Cub Swanson's in a really interesting part of his career because it did look like it was kind of over. Let's be honest. I compare him a lot to like an Andre Arlovsky. There was a time when you thought, wow, like this is kind of going to end in a very sad way. But Swanson, much like Arlovsky, has been able to find this sort of second end of career resurgence. It's been really nice to see too. And for Jonathan Martinez, if you've been watching this channel, you know how high I am on Jonathan Martinez. But this is probably his last chance to kind of break through. He's got a lot of big opportunities against some really good fighters, and he's never really been able to get that one big win. If you lose to Cub Swanson, you're probably not ever going to get another big opportunity like that. But on the flip side, if you beat a guy like Swanson, I mean, there's a real chance you can get a ranked opponent your next time out. So I think this is a really fun fight for both guys.
Well, a giant shot for both of these guys. And if you look at it, you want a shot in the arm at 125. I mean, Askarov taking on Brandon Royval. And for both of these guys, you can say, well, hey, one of them is a wrestling specialist, while the other one usually has some counters to that. If you look at it and you say, okay, well, one of these guys is a very good striker, I could counter you and say, well, the opposite is true. So if you look at Askarov and Brandon Royval, maybe Askarov doesn't have as fan-friendly of a style. And when I did the deep dive, I figured, okay, well, Royval more conducive to getting a finish in one of these fights. But that's not so. I mean, for Askarov in the UFC, he has earned more decision wins. Well, it's all of his decision wins have been in the UFC.
But go back and watch the tape with ACB when he was getting guys by Twister. Former ACB flyweight champ is Askarov. And if you look at it for Roybal, this guy's been doing the damn thing. A fight of the night in a one-round fight is last time out.
Which is insane. That's why everybody likes Brandon Roybal. Like, I know people who barely watch MMA, and they're like, I've watched this Roybal guy fight a few times now. I really like doing it. Because it's always going to be one of those kill or be killed style of fights. Jimmy Manuel is the fighter that I always bring up when we reference these kind of guys. But Brandon Roybal is a very exciting guy. Can get it done on the mat, can get it done on the feet. And for Askarov, it does feel like he is a steadier version of Roybal, a Roybal who might be less apt to take some big risks. So I think this is a really fun fight. And you're right, I don't really know if this is a title eliminator, but you do know the winner of this is probably going to find themselves in a title eliminator, or maybe one of those weird cases where it's like, okay, the winner of this and Pantoja both kind of only have a half claim to a title shot. Maybe we do get some fun rematches coming out of that fight.
Big time matchups on the card. Let us know down below in that comment section who you have as a fight of the night on this one. You have 12 fights to choose from. You're not wrong until Saturday night. Throw it down there in the comment section. When you look at this card on super short notice before we tape the damn thing, Joannerson Brito originally scheduled for a bout against Melzik Bogdazaryan at featherweight. Bogdazaryan out due to a broken hand. Insert Fusion XL's Lucas Alexander. He's 7-2. He's a striking specialist. He is well-rounded, but it makes for a very fun matchup for that debuting Brazilian fighter in Alexander to take on the wild man that is Brito. So a fun matchup there. You were originally scheduled to get Daniel Rodriguez coming off a controversial win against Li Jingliang back at the big time pay-per-view that we had not that long ago. Rodriguez scheduled for Magny. Rodriguez out due to an elbow injury. He talked about that on his Instagram. So that fight dissolved for now. We'll see if Magny gets a replacement opponent. But if you do look at it overall, four ranked opponents, two in the main event, two in your flyweight marquee between Askarov and Brandon Roybal. Up and down this card, though, a lot of legends, old prospects, which we hate to kind of talk about. Like, is Alonzo Menafield still a prospect? I don't know. He's 34 years old. He's been around for a while. Is Victor Henry still a prospect? He's got almost 30 fights.
Exactly.
And he's about 35 years old. He is a man. He's 35. Taking on a man who's 40 in Rafael Asunso, Vergara, and one of Japan's hottest prospects in Tatsuro Taida. There are a lot of fun matchups on this card. Again, this is the Fight Night Pick special. This is the one you stick around for. You listen to it in the car, on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, on the plane. You enjoy it. You digest it. I have a lot of fun breaking this one down with you.
It is a really fun card. Again, this is one of those cards where on face value, you might not be all that excited. You look at the main event and you roll your eyes. But when you do actually do the deep dive on the card, there's a ton of really fun fights. Manny Martinez versus Brandon Davis isn't going to decide who the next champion is. I can admit that right now. Is it going to be a heck of a fun fight for as long as it lasts? Yes, it will be. And I think there's a lot of other fights in this card that are very similar to that matchup.
Well, listen, it is a big time card. Question mark kicks 2 hours before the prelims on Saturday. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say, let's get into it. As the records would suggest, this is more than likely a fight on your local promotion's prelim undercard of a banger. We have 1-1 with a no contest, Mike Jackson, taking on Dead Game Pete Rodriguez, who's 4-1. And if you do look at this matchup, you might go, well, guys, like Pete Rodriguez, he's 4-1. Like, he must be an absolute banger. Oh, he is, and he unfortunately took on a very, very good fighter in a short-notice UFC debut when he took on Australia's Jack Della Maddalena, and in that matchup, he could not figure out the jab, and it was double-up, triple-up from Della Maddalena until Pete Rodriguez's nose was melted like a stick of butter. He got dropped over, and that was pretty much the end of that contest. So for Pete Rodriguez, looking to pick up the pieces, you got to kind of look at where the grass is greener. You got to watch those fights that he had with Icon and the various other promotions of his amateur career, because for Rodriguez, 7-2 as an amateur, and if you go down through it, he had contests at light heavyweight and middleweight. This guy's a small welterweight. Isn't that insane that he fought at some of those lower weight classes?
It's like hearing that Alexander Volkanovski used to weigh at 218 pounds. I don't know if you know the stat or not, Craig, but it is kind of wild because you're right. You don't look at Pete Rodriguez and think, wow, this is a guy who did compete in multiple weight classes above the one that he's in right now, because he does fit into the welterweight division quite comfortably. I don't really think he would fight at light heavyweight, you know?
No, to me, he almost looks like a lightweight, and that was kind of the commentary's reasoning in his fight with
Jack Della. Maybe this is going to be a guy that drops down. And ultimately, Rodriguez gets a shot against Mike Jackson. We talked about Mike Jackson quite a bit on this channel. He's also an MMA media member. You know him from The Truth. And he takes pictures at a lot of different events.
Very nice.
The LFAs and so on and so forth. But his UFC career is his MMA career, and that's kind of the craziest part about it. You look at his last fight, he took on Dean Barry. It was ruled a disqualification loss to Dean Barry. First, a little cup check, referee Chris Tione, okay, watch the cup check. Second time, spin kick to the nuts, cup check, and then we ultimately get a stoppage. Hard warning. Third one, eye rake, fingers go in, and Daniel Cormier wasn't happy about it, and I'll play the soundbite on that one right here.
Or it's going to go down as a no contest.
There's no chance the official calls this a disqualification.
Right, you don't think?
There's no chance. These guys, they would never do that.
But if you do focus in on it, for Mike Jackson, picks up his first win, and you might go, well, guys, doesn't he have another win? Wasn't he featured on UFC 225? Didn't I pay my hard-earned money to see him fight Chick Magnet Punk?
He did.
You're fucking right, you did. And in that fight, I've never seen a guy more unenthused to be in top position, landing ground and pound, than Mike Jackson, who was, like, looking away listlessly. Like, he was looking away into the crowd, just kind of punching
away.
Do
you know what I compare that fight to? Feel free to disagree. I look at that fight a lot like Alexander Volkov versus Greg Hardy. Remember how bad of a fight that was? But it was just one of those fights where you could tell that one guy was much better than the other one. So why put yourself in any position to take any big risks? That's the way I always looked at that fight. Because CM Punk, let's just be honest, is not an MMA fighter. Perfect. We got that out of the way.
Heck of an MMA commentator.
And I don't know if you've ever seen this guy in the WWE, but boy, was he a good wrestler at one point. For Mike Jackson, it's very difficult to break down any of his fights like we do break down most of the UFC fighters' fights, because there is a clear path for how most people get into this organization. I know there's some weird people whose topology records don't always match up, but for the most part, there is a way to get into the organization. You do really well in the regional scene, you get featured on, you know, some kind of a Fight Pass show or a show that is then on Fight Pass. The UFC sees you, and then you get signed. Mike Jackson became a professional MMA fighter so he could fight, well, okay, Mickey Gall, to be fair, he fought Mickey Gall, just so then the winner could go on and fight CM Punk. I don't necessarily look at Mike Jackson, his whole transition into MMA, or his progression throughout MMA, and think, wow, we're definitely going to see a much different product this time around than we ever have seen in the past. And it's weird to say this, but good on him for at least getting a UFC win his last time out there. I know it wasn't, like, as legitimate as many other UFC wins come by, but at least he does have that green mark on his record for a guy that I never thought would be able to get one at this level.
Dean Barry was a minus 1125 favorite in that matchup, and it was absolutely insane that it did end by disqualification. So you go down through it, you look at Mike Jackson, you've seen Crew Bob Perez in his corner for all of his fights out of Main Street Boxing and Muay Thai. And for Jackson, they'll touch on it. He's a Houston Golden Gloves champ. You look at the way that he does fight. He will throw the occasional kick, but then there's a big reset behind it. But it is when he's flowing with his boxing combinations. He's the type of fighter that does hold his hands quite low, but not like the Julian Arosa that I tend to reference a lot on this channel. They're low, and then he throws from odd angles, but he will kind of get backed up, and that is the trouble. With Jackson, Bobby Green's kind of the guy that exemplifies the shoulder roll defense, but Mike Jackson will shoulder roll, drop his hands, and bring his head back at the same time, and he gets countered by a lot of right hooks when he's fighting these welterweights. And again, Mickey Gall, Chick Magnet Punk, Dean Barry. It is something that he's been hit by in these fights. If you look at it for Jackson, though, it is his best path to his skill set is his boxing. So when you match him up against a guy like Pete Rodriguez, Pete, Dead Game, I don't know if I love the nickname, not so much. I mean, The Truth is probably better than Dead Game.
I think so.
But for Rodriguez, he was knocking guys dead on the regional scene, and that's what you love. And what I do like out of Pete Rodriguez is he's not really the biggest kicker in the world either, but his hands are very quick. He throws a lot of uppercuts, which you don't see all the time, especially from the lead arm, because he's a southpaw. He'll feint the left uppercut and then throw the right. Like, it really does kind of flip up his opponents. He'll run in, throw flying knees. He is a very wild striker, but good boxing combinations, good power at the end of his shots. But overall, when you do look at a matchup like this, I mean, talking about Mike Jackson, his opponent was a minus 1125 favorite. Barry was winning just about every moment of that fight until he started to throw some illegal shots, and then he was ultimately cut from the promotion. For Jackson, though,
similar skill set from when he came into the UFC in 2016 to what we saw earlier on this year. And this is just the first time he's ever had two fights in the same year.
And thing about Jackson is, both these guys do excel with their boxing, and I do expect them to use that in this fight. But the thing is, Pete Rodriguez has incredible power and 4-ounce gloves. If you don't have, like, perfect defense, one of those shots is going to catch you at a certain point. And the fact that he is so much younger, and the this is, like, what Pete Rodriguez does. He came in to fight Jack Della Maddalena, one of the best, I think one of the best prospects in this welterweight division. I don't think that's a hot take at all. It's like Ian Geary, Maddalena, and if you still want to consider Shavkat, I guess go right ahead. But there's not a lot of prospects at that level in this division right now. And the fact that Pete Rodriguez lost to him doesn't mean that you can completely write him off. Like, I really do feel like this is too much of a step down in competition after. And maybe this is just a good way to get Pete Rodriguez back on the horse. But I just don't know why you have to do Mike Jackson so dirty in this matchup.
Well, for Rodriguez, 8 days notice when he took on Jack Dellen. If you're trying to find Pete Rodriguez tape, you might have to look it up as Pete Rodriguez or as Pedro Rodriguez for those astute watchers and listeners that are trying to find tape on their own, as you should. For Mike Jackson, if you want to go see that CM Punk fight where it's billed as a no contest because he decided to puff a left-handed cigarette before the fight, go for it. Fill your boots. You look at the odds for this matchup, Matt. Rodriguez opened a minus 400 favorite, minus 677 right now on best fight odds. For Mike Jackson, open plus 300, plus 472 as it stands. The real question in this one, is Rodriguez going to be able to close the gap? Is he going to be able to also mix it to the body? Because he loves to throw the hook to the body, lead right hook to the body. He'll throw a jab there as well to mix it up a little bit. And a lot of his fights go very, very quick. If you focus on it for Rodriguez, the 4-1 and the 4-1-1 on that record is he beat guys as a pro that were 2-2, 0-1, and 5-1. And that was Roberto Pixley. And he beat a guy who was 1-0. But Pixley was 5-1. All five of Pixley's wins were over debuting fighters, so not really the best level of competition for Rodriguez coming into the UFC, but it was all those first-round finishes that he had accrued. We have a look on Tapology for the total votes on this one, Matt. It's a surprise to us as it is to you. Now, Pete Rodriguez is a giant favorite, and I'm assuming that the fans are going to have him, so I'm going to say over-under 92.5% Rodriguez.
I'll say over.
I'm going to say over. It's over 1,401 total votes. 95% Rodriguez, 87% by knockout for the 5% that have Mike Jackson, 48% by decision, 33% by knockout. There is no disqualification banner on Tapology, so I don't know if that's going to happen. But Matt, when I do look at this one, maybe Jackson can stick behind the jab, similar to what Jack Della was able to do, keep Pete Rodriguez at range, and then he's just kind of whiffing at air, trying to throw those power shots. But for me, I do like Rodriguez switching body to head in a matchup like this. I think he can back up Jackson, and I really do like that lead right hook that he loves to throw, especially with Jackson shoulder rolling, leaving his head exposed.
I still think Jackson can threaten with enough other areas of his game. Let's say Jackson and Rodriguez are even boxing. I just don't think Jackson's going to have those other areas where, okay, now it's going to start to put doubt into the mind of Rodriguez to where his boxing can open up even more. And that's why I do think Pete Rodriguez is a great chance to win this fight. I expect a lot of blitzes early. And I do think that once he is able to get on the inside of the range of Mike Jackson, he should be able to get the win at that point.
We'll see if the man who represents Main Street Boxing and Muay Thai and formerly 4-Ounce Fight Club, Mike Jackson, can get his second consecutive UFC win. Or will it be Pete Rodriguez out of Dominate MMA in Arizona getting his first UFC victory? Matt, both of us going with Dead Game Pete Rodriguez, changed the nickname. It is a big time matchup in the welterweight division with no rankings whatsoever involved in this one. We have a big time main event, Alexa Grasso taking on Viviani Araujo, that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Coming up this weekend, flyweight up-and-comers looking to pick up the lower rung ranked fighters in the flyweight division. We have Pete Spratt's protege, CJ Vergara, taking on Japan's Tatsuro Taeda. Matt, how do you think my flow was at the start of that one?
That's pretty good.
You think it was pretty good? Like, do you think I could be the next, like, buck 65 out of the Maritimes?
I do not.
You don't think so? Like, old days, golden, covering the bases, back when we used to punch each other in the faces. Do you ever listen to Buck 65?
My ears hurt right now.
Like, he's from Mount Uniac, Nova Scotia. Either way, we will let the fans hear about this flyweight matchup between one of Japan's hottest prospects in Tatsuro Taeda. You look at it, you have a couple of other fighters that are kind of making moves. I mean,
overall, there's not a lot of Japanese fighters in the UFC, so it is big to see a guy like Tatsuro, who was the former Shooto champion at flyweight, make the move into the UFC, have a very dominant win in his UFC debut against Carlos Candelario, looking to move forward against kind of a similar opponent to Candelario in CJ Vergara, and you kind of look at it. Camp for Candelario, you're going to be defending takedowns, trying to get off a bottom because Candelario has a lot of ground and pound abilities. To Vergara, who has had to rally in both of his UFC fights, loses to Ode Osborne, but has nearly a 10-8 third round in that matchup. And against Clayton Rodriguez, well, I thought Rodriguez won that fight, but the judges didn't. Vergara ends up getting the split. It's his first UFC victory. I really do like CJ Vergara's style, and I do think it's one that'll last in the UFC. I think he's decently well-rounded, but it's the fact that he's had to rally in a couple of these fights that gives me a little bit of pause against this young up-and-comer out of Japan in Taeda.
Well, Tatsuro was so hot before he came into the UFC. Like, people were really excited about his UFC debut. I know I was, for sure. And if you do go back and watch a lot of the tapes today, you notice that he does have a really unorthodox skill set. He likes high-body trips. Like, he's a really good grappler. He's a really good wrestler. You look at him and you understand how physically strong he must be when he is in that cage, but he just has a really unique style of his wrestling. It was just, okay, how is the striking going to translate over to the UFC? Because up until he did show up, it wasn't a lot of single strikes. It wasn't a lot of putting combinations together, but he looked like he upgraded it before he came over, I gotta be honest, and that made me reassess where I do think his whole ceiling is, because I think there is a world where Tatsuro does go on a really big win streak to start his UFC career. I'm not gonna say it goes on like a Hamza where it's okay, you're entitled to discussion five fights in, but I really do think Tatsuro could have one of those careers where he's firmly entrenched in that top 15 for a long time to come.
You might not believe us, you can find those Shooto fights very readily on YouTube, but if you watch Taeda there, it's single shot reset, body lock takedown with a trip. Like, he does have unorthodox takedowns, and that is the biggest part of his game. Oh, yeah. It's getting the fight down to the mat and threatening with submissions. He's great in the scrambles. And then if you compare just the fights that he had over in Japan to his UFC debut, he almost looked like a much leveled up fighter. And if you compare it, I mean, look, Vergara already in his prime. He's 31 years old. Tatsuro is only 22. And if you consider it even just statistically against Candelario, 43-0 were the strikes in the third round of that.
Pretty
one.
Impressive.
Candelario gets an early takedown. Tatsuro ends up on top for the majority of the round. And by the end of it, the elbows were just vicious. He drops him with a right cross in the second round of the fight. And in the first round, 15-10, it was relatively close. It was a feeling out process. And again, I can't stress this enough. Like, you look at it, Kanako Murata is another big prospect, but she broke her arm in her last fight, so she's been out for a while. We had Kinoshita on Dana White's Contender Series. He's kind of the future of Japan. Taeda's already there and making those moves. And for Vergara, I mean, it really is tough. I mean, he picks up the win over Bruno Correa over on Dana White's Contender Series, finishes him, and that's a UFC veteran. You don't often see Pete Spratt, the guy who beat Robbie Lawler in the corner of many UFC fighters. So you know that's a little bit special, and the broadcast is going to play off of that. But again, there's 18 unranked UFC flyweights right now in the UFC fan rankings. These are two of them with a big shot to move up. Maybe a fight like a Tagir Ulanbekov next. I don't think that's too far of a stretch for both of these guys. But again, for Taeda, it is those unorthodox takedowns. I just wonder, will he struggle with the takedown defense against a guy like Vergara, who will tend to chain a lot of them together?
I don't think he will, and I do think the fact that Vergara does chain them is really important, because Taeda is really good at, okay, I might not get the takedown, you might take me down, but that's not really when the grappling begins. Like, the grappling begins once we're on the ground. And for Tatsuro, he does excel in that reverse grappling. He is good at getting back on top of his opponents, even after it looks like they've been able to complete a takedown attempt on him. It's just, he does have a really unique skill set that we don't often see in the UFC. You don't normally see guys who, now yes, his striking has improved quite a bit, but still, guys who do a lot of those high body trip takedowns, guys who are willing to give up the takedown, even though I would still classify them mostly as a grappler. Just a really unique skill set, and that's why I do like this matchup. He's fighting a guy who, like you had mentioned, is a very similar matchup to his UFC debut. It's just Vergara's a little bit more leveled up in most areas, and that's why it should test Tatsuro quite a bit more.
For Vergara, he was a +170 underdog against Ode Osborne. He was a +270 against Rodriguez his last time out. He won that fight by split decision. I'll take it to my grave that I thought Rodriguez won it, but Regardless started this, we have a look at the odds in this matchup. And Vergara coming in at a plus 230. He's now a plus 193. For Taeda, open a minus 270, minus 240. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Surprise to us as they are to you. Taeda is one of those prospects. He is undefeated, as we all know. He was an amateur champion in Japan as well. So the O's are still there.
Yeah.
Matt, I'm going to say over under 90% Taeda.
I was thinking like 82. I'll say above 90, though.
You're going to say above 90? It is exactly 90. 1,382 total votes, 90% Taeda, 43% by decision, 46% by submission. For the 10% that have Vergara, 60% by decision, 21% by knockout. I think Taeda gets the win, and the reason why I like him in a matchup like this, for Rodriguez, he kind of gets stuck once he got taken down, and he couldn't really get out of the precarious positions against Vergara. Rodriguez is a very, very wonky striker, and that's where he had a lot of his success in that fight. Ode Osborne is good with his defensive submissions, but once he gets taken down, he can get held down as well. For me, with Taeda, I've seen him taken down on the regional scene, but I've seen him scramble out of position. I've seen him snatch up an arm to then kind of slink his way over to the back. He really is a tricky grappler. I think his time spent in the States getting ready for his last fight obviously accentuated his striking, but back over in Japan, he can really focus up with his original team, get ready for some of those kind of scrambles on the mat. So for me, I do like Japan's Taeda in this one. I like the level up that I've seen in the striking. Vergara, always a sneaky underdog, but I do like Taeda here.
And I think Tatsuro could get better. That's the thing. Like, if we saw that big of an improvement between his second to last and last fight, I'm not counting out another step up that he could have taken in between the time off between his last fight and this one. I think Tatsuro is going to be one of those prospects we're going to talk about for a long time. I would like to see him, though, if he does get the win over Vergara, give him one of those Victor Henry, Rafael dos Anjos style fights. Give him a guy in the flyweight division who's been around.
Give him a Tim Elliott.
I think that's a good call. Mateusz Nicolau might be a little bit too high in the division, but you get the idea. Just someone who's been around for a long time, since before they kind of got rid of the division and brought it back. Like, if Dustin Ortiz was still around, that would have been the perfect opponent.
A great fight. Bring back Dustin Ortiz. Bring back the Monkey God. Just do a one championship trade. I'd love to see that. Both of us going with Japan's Taeda to get the win. We have a big time card, including 2022 UFC Hall of Famer Cub Swanson taking on Jonathan Martinez in the co-main event. You're not going to want to miss that one. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Nicknames that rhyme, sort of, with first names. Coming up in the women's strawweight division, we have Piera La Fiera Rodriguez taking on Sam Beach, Sam Hughes. And I will say this, and I'm going to start the video off right here. Go ahead.
We call out too many people and say they have awful nicknames to not immediately say Sam Hughes, Sam Page. Sam Page is a bad one, too.
Sam Page isn't the best, but what I will say is, for Sam Hughes, she was a fighter coming into the UFC. If you just watch her fight with Vanessa Demopoulos, which is an L, and you just consider up until she gets caught in the inverted triangle, that was a very impressive fight. She was on her way to winning the LFA Strawweight Championship. So with me, that fight held a lot of water. And when I watched her fight Tisha Torres, you think, okay, well, listen, the skill disparity there, it's on display. It doesn't make a lot of sense.
Just one of those debuts that you felt bad for the fighter. You could tell that it was okay. This is your best chance to get into the big organization, but a really bad opportunity to be given.
Yeah,
it was just a bad one.
It was on really short notice. It didn't make a lot of sense. She loses that fight. She loses to Loma Lookbanmi, gets kind of out-wrestled and outstruck on that one. Loses to Luana Pinheiro, who I hold in high regard. I think her judo is great, her jiu-jitsu is great, her fight against Randa Marcos is weird. But for Sam Hughes, you're kind of passing the buck at this point. She loses to Demopoulos in a fight that she was winning. She comes into the UFC, she loses three straight. I didn't know what to expect out of Sam Hughes. And then she made a giant career choice. She decided, okay, I've been billed out of the Pacific Northwest. I have a great cardio background. What was it, Wofford?
Track and field.
She's got that base to her game. She can wrestle a bit. She can strike a bit to get into the clinch to take the fight down to the mat. It's just building on those skills. She completely changed her life, moved it down to Texas, started going to Fortis MMA, and son of a bitch, she's won two fights in a row, and she has that Sam Page to her game. She looks mean in these fights. She's mixed it up. You consider her first win in the UFC's octagon. She beats Estela Nunes. She loses the first round handily with the striking, and then Nunes starts to just kind of lose a little bit of her oomph. The takedowns come easier to Sam Hughes as the fight goes on. She's able to get it done, but was it a 10-8 first round? Maybe. And then Hughes really does take over. And if you consider last fight against Elise Reed, for Reed, pure kickboxer, small for the division. Where is the takedown defense going to come into play? Sam Hughes is able to take over in that fight. And the thing that I love most about that fight, she's able to finish it late in the third round and continue to have that kind of aggressiveness to her style. So the last two fights, Saif Saud's going to yell at you right in your ear until you're just completely deaf. For Sam Hughes, it seems to work. And in those last two fights, we've kind of seen that fighter again.
I would agree, but this is the thing about Sam Hughes. I still think she fights in the exact same manner she's always fought. I just think she's better at getting the fight to where she can have more success. Because for Hughes, she's always had that really good cardio. I just don't think she ever had a way to weaponize the cardio up until recently. Because now she can just walk forward with a lot of pressure, make you feel her presence in the cage, threaten with the wrestling, threaten with some of the striking, and that can wear down on her opponent as the fight does go on, and that's what we've been able to see in her last two. I just don't know if that's a sustainable style once she does start to fight some of the better fighters in this division again. Let's say she does go up and fight a Loma Lookman-Me again. And I know Loma had some scary positions in her last fight, but she was still able to get the win. I don't think the style of Sam Hughes is now all of a sudden going to overcome some of the challenges that she wasn't able to overcome before. I still think she's trying to get the fight into the same area she's always been trying to get the fight into. I just think that her technique has been somewhat refined and it has allowed her to then become the better wrestler. It's just with Hughes, she's going to have to add some kind of a wrinkle to her game on the feet. It's not that her wrestling and her cardio hasn't improved and that it's not good enough to get her wins. It's just a lot of these fighters don't overly respect her striking. Look at someone like Estela Nunes, who, like, I don't really think Nunes is going to be around in the UFC for years and years and years and go on and have, like, a multi-fight win streak. You get the idea. If Estela Nunes is really giving you trouble on the feet to where, like you had said, it's a borderline 10-8, then I do worry about you once you start to fight some of the better strikers in this division.
Well, and the reason we start the video off with Sam Hughes to begin with is the fact that, again, she can weapon her cardio, and for Piera Rodriguez, you look at her last two fights, Dana White's Contender Series, she picks up a giant win over Valeska Machado, whose nickname is Tina Black. She wins that fight by decision, kind of loses the first round, rallies back round two, round three, and in her last fight against Kay Hansen, loses the first round, rallies back round two, round three. Can she have that rally, or will it be a big storm in the first round? Because if you know anything about Piera Rodriguez, even getting ready for her last fight, she trains with great fighters at a Black House MMA. You have seen fighters like Sabina Mazo on her Instagram. You've also seen Tabitha Ricci, somebody who can really get it done it at the all three levels, really, in the MMA octagon. But for Rodriguez, she went over to All-Stars MMA to train with some of the best for her wrestling to get ready for Kay Hansen. And in the matchup, she just kind of struggled with all three levels of the game in the first round. But round two, round three, she's defending takedowns. She's utilizing great boxing combinations, and that's the best part of her game. Out of Venezuela, her kickboxing is very good. Her boxing combinations are lightning fast and with power as well. It's something you don't see very often in this division, what Rodriguez has. And the other thing about her, if you watch any of UFC Fight Pass, she's in commercials all the damn time. She's had one UFC fight. It's kind of crazy to see that. But both of these women, unranked in the division, both of them could be considered halfway prospects, but at the same time, they're also, I mean, one just turned 30 in Sam Hughes, and one's a few weeks away from her 30th birthday in Rodriguez.
I think Rodriguez is going to watch a lot of that Tisha Torres fight and think to herself, I can kind of blitz her like Tisha Torres was able to. Now, Torres does, of course, have very high-level grappling and wrestling to go along with that, and she's one of the best fighters in this division. Like, that's just a really hard UFC debut for anybody to have. But if you look at the success that Torres was able to have in that fight, it was get on the inside of Sam Hughes' range and just make her feel your power. And Tisha Torres is not some stopper on the feet by any means. She's not a knockout artist. She's not a submission artist. Like, Tisha Torres is known for just going to decision, and I really do think that if Rodriguez can at least get Sam Hughes respect enough on the feet in that first round, I think it's going to make the fight a lot easier for her, because I think that might prevent Hughes from being that aggressive version of herself, who really makes her opponents feel her pace as that fight goes on, because it does, it's almost like a mind trick that you play on yourself. If you're throwing a lot at your opponent and they're just always in front of you and they never leave, never leave, never leave, you're going to start to feel that fatigue mentally and physically as that fight continues. I just think Rodriguez is the type of fighter who's going to be able to damage her enough in that first round to then make Sam Hughes, of course, she's always going to have good cardio, but it's going to level it off, I think, as that second and the third round continues. Because again, Rodriguez is not some fighter who's just going to go out there, blow herself off in the first round, And then I did not say that right at all. Blow low in the first round. And then not have anything left to give in the second and third round, like Sam Hughes' last couple opponents have been, because that's sort of the archetype that they've been cut out of. I just think Rodriguez is that much more dangerous in the feet, and Hughes is still yet to show that evolution in her game.
I gotta be honest, I don't know if blow herself off or blow her load. I don't know which one's better or worse, but when you do look at it for Rodriguez, you face an opponent who will switch levels. She will bring her hands down quite a lot, and it takes a second to bring them back up. And she can struggle with the striking defense in those positions, something that Hughes could take over with. And for Rodriguez, I don't know, she had that anger when she was fighting for the strawweight title over with LFA. She was able to get it done. Sam Hughes, victory, jaws the defeat, wasn't able to make it work. But for Rodriguez, walked out to Slipknot back then. Her walkout song on her UFC debut was Legend by the Score. That's the weakest fucking song I've ever heard, and I hate it much. I hate that song. Everybody plays it. I hate that game. I hate that song. You look at the odds in this matchup. Rodriguez, the favorite, open to minus 230, minus 190. For Sam Hughes, opened a plus 190, plus 155. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprise to us as they are to you. I'm going to say over under 72.5% Rodriguez.
I think they'll be over. I really do.
I think they're going to be over. They're over. 1,374 total votes, 85% Rodriguez, 87% by decision for the 15% that I have Sam Hughes, 78% by decision. And I would think that Sam Hughes would win by decision as well. I mean, against Elise Reed, she did great work from that top position. Yeah. You love that third round finish. I'm just eager to see who gets the first round and who's able to rally, because both of these women have similar fights in that respect. Not similar styles, but similar fights in that respect. I like the boxing. I like the combinations out of Rodriguez, where she can pick her power shots as well. Something that, again, you don't see very often in the strawweight division. So I'm going with Rodriguez based on the accumulation of volume and damage here. But you could like Sam Hughes, again, with the cardio, with the wrestling, with this newfound kind of Sam Page fighter that we've seen out of Fortis MMA lately. But for me, it's La Fiera out of Blackhouse MMA.
Yeah, I just think Rodriguez is the much more damaging fighter in this matchup. And if that is the case, unless Sam Hughes is able to go out there and just really dominate with her wrestling in that second and third round, I think the strikes of Rodriguez are going to be able to win out in a lot of these exchanges. And like you said, it is going to be interesting to just see who decides to start to come on when. Like, who decides to try to go out there and win that first round quick? Who decides to try to play the long game in the second and third? I just think Rodriguez has the stability in her game to be able to win not only the first, but the third as well. And that's why I like Rodriguez in this matchup.
And a big time matchup in the strawweight division. Let us know who you have here. Will it be Venezuela's Rodriguez? Will it be the Pacific Northwest's own Sam Hughes? Comment that one down below. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Former bantamweight title contender on his Henan Barão, training with Henan Barão, we have Rafael Assuncao looking to avoid his fifth straight defeat, taking on La Mangosta Victor Henry. And for both of these guys, very, very, very advanced in age in the bantamweight division. You don't often see a lot of success out of guys over 35. You have recently Dominic Cruz, recently retired Jose Aldo.
Dominic Cruz just got head kicked.
I mean, Frankie Edgar. But you've seen guys have some longevity in the division. And for both of these guys, they're looking to pick up some success. Now, for Victor Henry, his UFC debut on short notice, gets COVID, misses 2 weeks, takes on Jaime Barcelos, and outstrikes him. And that win is very, very, like, it's glowing hardcore weekend, just based off how good Barcelos looked his last time out a couple of weeks ago against Trevin Jones. And for La Mangosta, the craziest part about it is he outstruck Barcelos. That's not even the best part of his game. The best part of his game is grappling and his jiu-jitsu. And he has great wrestling takedowns into mixing his martial arts. You look at the lineage. I mean, trains at a CMMA in California. Weber Almeida, main training partner, guy who's been doing the damn thing over with Bellator. And for Henry, he's got that kind of karate base to his game to mix in with his grappling, similar to Almeida, who's a protege of Lyoto Machida. And Victor Henry is a protege of, I don't know, catch wrestling's own Josh Barnett, former UFC heavyweight champ. Just crazy the background that Henry has.
And good on Victor Henry. Because like you had said, no guys in the bantamweight division over 35 tend to have levels of success at all. And we're talking about fighters who've been in the top 15 for years and years and years. So just good on Victor Henry for at least getting this opportunity so late into his MMA career. And good on the UFC for rewarding him in his UFC debut by giving him a guy like Rafael Assuncao in his second fight. Because, okay, you beat Jaime Barcelos. That that's a good win, but not everyone's all that sold on Haney. You beat Rafael of Sun Tzu. Yes, he's been on a losing streak, but people still know and recognize the name of Sun Tzu for his win over Dillashaw all those years ago, and for the fact that he was a top five fighter for what felt like a decade.
Well, yeah, what was it like, Matt, from 2011 to 2018?
Don't worry, I'm going to start telling people. I'm a little slanderous on Rafael of Sun Tzu, and I'm going to admit this right now.
But people were running away in the streets from that period of time. If you look at it from 2011 to 2018, Sun Tzu lost one fight. It was a decision to TJ Dillashaw. But you consider the names of the guys he beat. Dillashaw, Aljamain Sterling, Pedro Munhoz, Marlon Moraes when it meant something, Rob Font. Like, Sun Tzu's had one of those sneaky little bantamweight careers where it's like, okay, you didn't win the World Series, but you won a couple of Cy Youngs. Do you make it to the Hall of Fame? In Sun Tzu's case, probably not. But the wins really do speak for themselves on his record.
They do! But this is when I'm going to come in and get a little slanderous. I didn't think Rafael Sun Tzu should have been a top five fighter for all those years. If you go back and actually watch a lot of these fights, the Sterling fight was really close and Sterling was young in his career. I thought he lost the first Marlon Moraes fight. He beat Matthew Lopez, who wasn't good at all. Let's just call it what it is. Like, he flying kneed Matthew Lopez and hit him with an overhand right. Matthew Lopez wasn't in the UFC for any length of time. He beat Rob Font and that was a great win. He beat the brakes off Rob Font. He dropped him on the feet and looked really good. But other than that Rob Font win, he was just kind of coasting off the fact that he beat TJ Dillashaw all those years before. And that was the weird thing about Sun Tzu. I liken him a lot to Ricardo Lamas, but in the bantamweight division. It really felt like he was one of those top five fighters who, okay, you're in the top five. That's good because you have good names on your resume. But you didn't look at Sun Tzu and think he wasn't going to lose to a lot of the guys in the top 15. There's top five fighters in every weight class where you think, okay, other than the champion and the number one contender, like, those guys aren't just going to lose to run-of-the-mill fighters. And Sun Tzu, I never felt like, was one of those guys. Yes, he could offer good fights, and maybe it has become the fact that his athleticism has slowly diminished over time to where, okay, now he isn't the same guy that he used to be. I just, with Sun Tzu, he's extremely well-rounded, but at this stage of his career, he doesn't have the best chin, and he's not the most durable. And even go back and watch the Marlon Moraes fight that started this whole losing streak. Like, he gets hit by one shot over the top and gets guillotined on the mat shortly after. With a Sun Tzu, there's some guys you can fight later on in into their career because they focus on things like power, and they don't really need volume, and they don't need a high level of explosiveness to get out their takedowns. Sun Tzu kind of needs all of those things in his game. And I just think at 40 years of age, he's regressed a little bit more than we would traditionally see fighters regress just because his style did use a lot of that athleticism early on in his career.
Well, I mean, Victor Henry is very much based on speed, volume, and his jiu-jitsu. But if you do look at it for Sun Tzu when he was in his prime, he didn't necessarily need speed and volume because he had a little bit of power to crack. He had good wrestling. He has good jiu-jitsu. He was primarily winning his fights by decision. But for Sun Tzu, a longtime ATT guy out of Atlanta, he switched up this training camp. He's down in Vegas. I mentioned that Henan Barao connection, but a lot of really good training partners that you've seen on Sun Tzu's Instagram. For Victor Henry, though, again, to try and focus through this, he was the Deep Jewels champion and SFC champ before coming into the UFC. But when you do look at him, he can mix these power shots. He's great in the scrambles. He's great with his jiu-jitsu. He just seems like a much quicker version of an Sun Tzu. And the thing that I really like out of Henry's last performance, not just outstriking a guy in Haney Barcelos, it was defending 6 of 7 takedown attempts from a legitimate wrestling champion out of Brazil in a guy in Barcelos who's still a little bit younger than a Sun Tzu. So we'll see if a Sun Tzu has been able to kind of find the fountain of youth in Vegas coming up this weekend. But you look at the odds in the matchup, a Sun Tzu open plus 195. He's plus 263 right now. And maybe if he didn't take that second Moraes fight, maybe he would have gotten a title shot a few years ago. It's crazy to play that one out. For Henry, open a minus 230, minus 342 right now. So we have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. They're surprised us there to you, but I doubt that they're very close. I'm going to say over under 85% Victor Henry.
I'll say under, but I think it'll be the favorite.
Poor Sun Tzu. 88% of 1,401 total votes, Henry. 37% by decision, 48% by knockout. For the 12% that have a Sun Tzu, 57% by decision, 19% by submission. So, Matt, I do think Victor Henry's going to be able to get it done in this fight. I think for a Sun Tzu, unless he can wrestle him and hold him down for long periods of time in the matchup, I don't really see a Sun Tzu getting the win because I just think Henry's quicker. He's got more pop on his shots. We've seen a Sun Tzu struggle with power lately, which everybody's going to struggle with power. If you have your hands down and need a full extension right hand from Cody Garbrandt, it doesn't matter what the year is. You're probably going to get knocked out. But for a Sun Tzu, he struggled with the pressure and the striking out of Ricky Simona's last time out, who has obviously leveled up a lot in his own striking, has Simone. I just think Henry kind of has a lot of answers to the questions that a Sun Tzu poses.
This fight reminds me a lot of Alex Morono versus Cowboy Cerrone. Yeah, both guys are a little bit older. Yeah, Cowboy older, of course, than Morono, but Morono's no spring chicken by any means. Just, I think Victor Henry's going to be the younger guy, and he's really going to be able to use that pace to his advantage against a Sun Tzu. I just don't want to see a Sun Tzu get knocked out again. He had a really good career. He is one of the more recognizable names from this division. So it is unfortunate that this is kind of how it might end, a five-fight losing streak that ends against Victor Henry, but I just want to get a really good fight out of this. I do think both guys' styles match up together very well, so we're probably going to get a three-round decision. I think it should be a really fun fight for as long as it lasts, because both these guys are really good at scrambling, so hopefully we get a great fight, but the prediction definitely is Victor Henry.
I mean, you kind of hope that it's the opposite of Seth Petruzzelli Kimbo Slice, and take it down to the mat. Just take it to the mat, and don't do any striking, Matt, both of us going with
fucking illegal.
La Mangusta, Victor Henry to get the win. A big time card in the co-main event. Kevin Swanson, better known as Cub, 2022 UFC Hall of Famer, taking on Dragon Jonathan Martinez. Should be a great fight. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it.
Jaden Malcoon, hell of a video game player. Excited to see if he can preserve this undefeated record. He is in the green trunks.
If you're a fan of Jordan Burroughs or Bo Nickel or Roddy Piper, maybe they should bring in Earl Hebner or Mike Chioda to referee this one. We have a couple of wrestler grapplers going at it at 185 pounds coming up this weekend. Nick Maximov representing Nick Diaz Academy, the Nick Diaz Army. He's taking on Robert Whittaker's buddy, Jacob Mamba Malcoon. And Jacob Mamba Malcoon, a big fan of one Kobe Bryant, but he's not like the Kobe Bryant of MMA at all. He wrestles and wrestles and wrestles. And Nick Maximov, he wrestles. For some reason, I struggled with his last name there. Matt, when you look at this fight, I wouldn't necessarily say that the style is conducive to an all-action type of fight, but if they both decide to strike, I think we could get an interesting fight.
Every weekend, I'm sure there's a fight on every single card that turns a casual fan into a hardcore fan. One of those fights where you didn't know either guy's name going into it, but after that fight's over, it really made you a fan of the sport. This fight's going to take hardcore fans and turn them into casuals. That's how bad I think this fight's going to be. Now, not to discredit either guy's skill set by any means, because don't worry, I'm going to get them their flowers. But it's not an aesthetically pleasing game whatsoever. And I think that's fair to say. Like, when we break down Max Holloway fights, you know what I say when we do that? They're really fun to watch. You know what? Max Holloway's awesome to watch compete in MMA. No one's ever said, cancel our plan Saturday night. Nick Maximov and Jacob Malcoon are about to fight. Like, babe, we can't go to dinner. We can't see your parents. We can't go hang out with our friends. Nick Maximov is on TV. I've got to be there to watch
it. Hold the fucking phone for just a second. They made Nick Maximov and Puna Soriano a co-main event in the last calendar year. How insane is that?
Because Puna puts butts into seats, I guess, because Nick Maximov sure as hell doesn't. This is the thing about this fight. The winner's going to be a name that nobody wants to fight because they have that kind of style that's going to make you look bad no matter what. Nick Maximov has had a lot of success up until this point in his career. And same thing for Jacob Malcoon. I would still say a little bit different because he is 2-2 in the organization. But still, for Maximov, up until his last time out, there wasn't really a reason to think, wow, this guy's wrestling can't be enough to at least get him a borderline ranking. And really, that's just because middleweight division is very wide open, especially the unranked fighters. But Maximov has shown that he hasn't really improved other areas of his game in the UFC up until that point. Now, his striking has gotten somewhat better, but he's still such a single striker that, or a single shot striker, I should say, that I do worry about him anytime he's going to fight anybody better than someone like Jacob Malcoon. I think this fight is going to be a lot of clinch work. I think we're going to get a lot of wrestling out of this. If that is the case, I do favor Nick Maximov's grappling after it does hit the mat. And I think for that, he might be able to just stay heavier on top longer. But this fight, to me, is very difficult to break down because I really do think whoever gets the offensive takedown and gets that top position is going to be at enough of an advantage from that point to where I think they can just ride out that one position.
Well, for Jacob Malcoon, he actually did have a pro boxing career. He went 3-0. He won the ADCC trials
down in
Oceania. And for Malcoon, it really is his bread gets buttered with his wrestling. And he went from a guy who got knocked out in, 18 seconds in his UFC debut against Phil Haas to, okay, he's Bobby Knuckles' buddy. We're putting him on the card. He's like Nick Diaz's Martin Sano. And then he was really able to kind of prove everybody wrong. And I had a bad taste in my mouth after Malkoon had that debut because I wasn't overly high on him even coming into the Phil Haas fight. I wasn't sure if he'd have any answers to the questions. He struggled with the pressure. It almost looked like a case of UFC jitters, too, because Haas is just walking him down, and Malkoon backs straight up. He's trying to kind of move around the outside of the cage. He just didn't look like he had much that night. Beats Abdulrazak Al-Hassan and just took him down and controlled him for large portions of the fight. Fought AJ Dobson, didn't really struggle from the jump. He looks like he's gaining his confidence. Yeah. And then his last time against Brendan Allen, that might just say unanimous decision. And Brendan Allen's a big name and you know him. But if you go back and watch that fight, Malkoon takes down Allen on half the takedown attempts. That's 7 of 14. And if you go on MMA decisions, out of the overall media scores, they scored it 9 to 8 in favor of Malkoon over Allen, 29-28 across. But that was a really, really close fight against a guy who's been around the top 15 for a time or two in Brendan Allen. That's really impressive out of Malkoon. And my other counter to you, with Nick Maximov, his fight against Andrzej Petrosky, what does Petrosky do? Power takedowns.
Oh, yeah.
Power submissions, which he ended up getting, what was it, the anaconda choke out of the roll when he was taking on Maximov. It was like the 10-finger guillotine, and I'm going to talk about a 10-finger guillotine in the co-main event in Cub Swanson's fights, but for Nick Maximov, just wasn't able to get out of that position, and that's where you figured he would excel. But if you rewind that fight and go into the striking, well, what does Petrosky do? Wings power shots to try and close distance. Maximov had good boxing combinations and nice kicks in that fight, so I really did like that out of him. But I think in this matchup, I do agree, like, are people gonna get like overly excited about this?
No,
maybe not. Maximov, in terms of the odds when he took on Petrosky, -365 favorite in that one, whereas for Malkoon, he's been hovering around an underdog throughout his UFC career. So you look at the odds in this matchup, and Maximov open to -140, -148 right now. Malkoon open +120, +125. The other thing about this, Maximov, huge wave of, I don't know, fan support from his fight that was technically at heavyweight when he made his Dana White's Contender Series debut. He was fighting a guy on super short notice. They moved it up to heavyweight. The guy weighed in up near the heavyweight limit, and Maximov was able to take him down. But if you will remember when he took on Oscar Cota on Contender Series, Dana White didn't sign him and said that he needs more seasoning. We want him on the Ultimate Fighter. He was able to just wait it out, get a fight against Cody Brundage, which was actually a closer fight. If you go back and rewatch it, Brundage had a lot of success in the striking, whereas Maximov was able to hold him down. The fight against Punas Soriano, same thing. It's just, can Maximov take that JUCO All-American status at a Clackamas College and apply it to a guy like Jacob Malkoon? We'll find out this weekend, but yeah, it's a tough fight when you're trying to break it down. And if you get this one right this weekend, feather in your cap, because this is a really hard one to try and actually make a prediction. It's easy to preview, it's hard to predict.
It is. It's one of those fights, too, where no matter what you're going to say, you're going to look bad because of it. Like, Jacob Malkoon could go out there, look really great on the feet, add some good kickboxing to his game, get our takedown, and just rinse and repeat the whole entire time. I think Maximo, though, I know we get caught in submissions last time out. I just think positionally, once they do hit the mat, when they do get into, you know, half guards, full guards, stuff like that, he's going to be a little bit heavier on top. And that's really the only thing from either guy that I can favor overwhelmingly amongst the other. Like, Jacob Malkoon does get a lot of those takedowns. But the problem is, when you secure 7 takedowns, the guy is getting up. It's like when, again, I'll never forget this. I listened to a grown man cry on radio one time because I was getting ready to listen to Luke Thomas' show on Sirius XM. And there's a wrestling show that happens right before. I think it's called Busted Open. I want to get the name right.
It is.
There was a guy and they were like, how's Ric Flair that good? And he was just truly called in. He was like, how's Ric Flair that good? If you're a 15-time world champion, it means you lost it 14 times. And Buddy wasn't there for any of it. He like went next level, lost his mind. With Malkoon, that's the same thing. You're getting these takedowns, but what else are you doing with them? Are you threatening with submissions? Are you getting good ground and pound? A lot of Malkoon is just sitting on top. So I guess ever so slightly, I'm going to favor Nick Maximov in this matchup, but this is a really hard fight to predict.
Well, we have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprise to us, it is to you. I'm going to say over-under. I think the fan support's still there, even though that co-main event wasn't great. Maximov lost the last fight. I'm going to say over-under 70% Maximov.
I think it'll be under, but I think it'll be the favorite.
And it's slightly under 1,362 total votes, 64% Maximov, 80% by decision. For the 36% that are Malkoon, 82% by decision. I'll be the dissenting party. For me, with Malkoon, when he's taking on a guy like Brendan Allen, it's a very close fight. It could have gone either way. It's a loss on his record. You take a guy like that down 7 times out of 14 attempts, that's really impressive. A guy like Maximov has good takedown defense. He has good defensive hips, and he can threaten in the scrambles with a lot of his own submissions. You see it with, like, he'll go armbar triangle to then try and sweep out of the
Will
position.
Will he not be a lot bigger, too?
I wouldn't be surprised if he was a lot bigger. You see it on the screen there. He's 6 feet tall to the 5'9 of Malkoon. Malkoon thick, though. And I think for Malkoon, he'll be able to at least keep that top pressure on a guy like Maximov. So ever so slightly, I have Malkoon. I'm eager to see how the striking plays out between these two guys, because I think Malkoon could be slightly better in the boxing. I do like the kicks out of Maximov. We'll see how it all shakes out. Let us know in the comments section who you have in a very, very tightly contested fight at middleweight. Will it be Maximov? Will it be Malkoon? In the co-main event this weekend, Cub Swanson, Jonathan Martinez. That's a great fight. In main event, flyweight frenzy between Alexa Grasso and Viviane Araújo. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Name Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Coming across the wire on short notice, Fight Night Picks, we've got your back. We have Tubarão, Joe Anderson, Brito taking on Lucas Alexander out of Fusion XL Martial Arts. And Matt, this is a great matchup here at featherweight. Originally, it was supposed to be Melzik Bogdasarian, a guy whose nickname is The Gun, taking on Brito. But Bogdasarian, I don't know, broke his hand. The magazine fell out. I don't know. Brito is now matched up with a fellow Brazilian training out of the States in Lucas Alexander. And if you've seen Alexander fight in the past, his last time out, he headlined Anthony Pettis Fighting Championships number 1. And he got a win over Jacob Kilburn, UFC veteran. Now, for those of you who are uninitiated, Jacob Kilburn had a run in the UFC. And he went outside and he fought in the PFL and he got flying knee knocked out by Brandon Jenkins. It hasn't been all, you know, sun and roses and all of the good things for Kilburn. But if you do look at it for Alexander, he does have an interesting style that I think projects a little bit of longevity in the UFC. It's just the level of competition hasn't been all that great for Alexander on the regional scene. We'll have to see how he kind of acclimatizes himself to that UFC level. But against a guy like Brito, you know the fight's going to be coming at you. So we'll see if Alexander's able to kind of play out to his strengths. And Matt, we really did focus on it. We talked about this before we started filming because, again, this fight was added on incredibly short notice on Sunday, the Sunday before the fights. So there's no odds on this one just yet. And we'll talk about the topology votes. There's one giant X factor to Lucas Alexander's game, and it's his leg kicks, and they're great.
And not just his leg kicks, I would say his kicks in general. He has really reactive kicks. He's really good at judging, okay, kick left foot, kick right leg. He's good at switching stances, too, on the back foot. That's the thing. Normally, kicks are only brought in when you're throwing a combination. You want to end it with a kick, end it with something really powerful. Alexander can kick off the back foot, though. And that's a really unique thing to see. And that requires absurd levels of balance to be able to do something like that. This fight, though, more than any other on the card, really comes down to at what range is it going to be contested at? Because if Alexander is able to fight at that really long distance, really long range, be able to use or utilize some of those kicks, he has a good straight right, too. The thing about his right hand is he doesn't throw it straight. He doesn't throw it in a hook. He throws like this weird up hook. I don't even know how to describe it. It's a very awkward style and it's a very awkward strike, but it does tend to land.
And he does hold his hands kind of low as well. So it's just weird angles where a lot of these strikes come from. And the other thing about him is you look at all of these fights that he's had and they're not with the bigger promotions. I mean, maybe Anthony Pettis FC will become some giant juggernaut of a promotion. It'll rival all the others. Maybe it'll be the next one championship. But with Combat Night Pro, with Island Fights, I mean, Island Fights a little bit of an outlier, but his last three fights, Combat Night Pro and Anthony Pettis, smaller cages. And with Pettis, it was a circular cage, kind of like Bellator. With Combat Night Pro, it was an octagon style, but they are smaller. And for a bigger guy frame-wise in the featherweight division, he does have a lot of success at judging range and earning it early on in these matchups.
He does, but he's never fought anybody with even an ounce of the explosiveness that Joe Anderson Brito carries. And that's the weird thing about Brito. Again, even in his last two fights, you've kind of got the whole entire experience. If you're really tactical and you can stay on the outside, threaten with your wrestling, and be well-rounded, you can beat Joe Anderson. If you're hesitant, though, If you're second guessing yourself, if you're pulling out of exchanges with your chin up, like Andre Feely was, then we kind of know how it's going to end. Like, Brito does embody that John Lineker mindset of, hey, I'm going to try to knock you out or I'm going to lose the decision trying. That's what I really do like out of Brito. But the thing is, he is going to have to find his own Goldilocks zone a little bit better. I like the pace. I like the aggressiveness. And it's not like he falls off a cliff as the fight continues, but he's going to have to find his own Paulo Costa, if you will. Figure out, okay, what is the best fighting pace for me so that I can have those big flurries, but I can also make that, or combine that, I should say, with the longevity to go three rounds. And I think if Brito can finally find a way to put those two things together, that's when he'll have his sort of Gilbert Burns moment of putting all of his mixed martial arts together and potentially even going on a run. Because I really do think Brito, if you look at his X factors, they're as good as anybody in the division. He is really unique for his ability to close the distance and land his power shots. It's just, is he going to be technical enough to finally be able to get over the hump and fight ranked fighters in the featherweight division? Because I feel like in featherweight and lightweight, more than any other division, it's, hey, you're a top 15 fighter or you're outside of the top 15. You really need to show something spectacular to prove that, okay, I am a ranked fighter and I deserve to be here.
I mean, Brito is kind of like your friend that goes camping, and did he bring the newspaper? Does he have the kindling? Did he chop his firewood just right? Because the guy definitely has that magnesium flint. You throw that down there, you light it, the kid burns hot. Dana White would say that. Now, he burns hot quick, and if you watch his fight over with LFA against Mariscal, he gets in his head right before the fight, and then he ends up finishing him in impressive fashion. You watch his fights on the regional scene, and sometimes he goes balls to the wall very quickly, and then he can lose in some of the grappling exchanges. He had that weird technical decision fight against Diego Lopes that had fought like some big names in and around the UFC. But for Brito, it's going to be the mixing of the martial arts, as you had mentioned. Can he burn hot enough, quick enough, or will he have the lasting power to keep that fire burning throughout the night? And for Lucas Alexander, the other big X factor here, because Alexander is more or less a kickboxer, but he will take the fight down to the mat and he will waste time up against the cage. And that's the thing that I don't really love in the fights that I've seen. He will take the fight, hold it up against the cage, not really go for takedowns, bring his wind back into it, and then I'll go for his takedown. And he goes for rear naked chokes, but kind of like a guy in AJ Dobson that you're going to see on the next pay-per-view card, he goes for a lot of no-hook rear naked chokes and doesn't really get them. So Alexander's a little fast and loose on the ground, whereas Brito is as well, but he can really bring it together. Obviously, you see the size difference between these two guys. Again, for Alexander, level competition, Kilburn was 8-6 at the time, then 6-4 Ty Johnson, 3-1 Reginald Mack the second, Carlos Guerra, who was 3-2, 6-7-1 Jeremias Fernandez. Like, not really a good level of competition on the regional scene. But when it does come down to this one, Matt, we'll go off the topology vote. Surprise us there to you. And there's going to be a really limited sample size. Again, I think Alexander has a frame and a style that could be conducive to more than one fight in the UFC. Like, Yoshinori Horii only got one.
Alexander has one of those styles where he could win his first four fights by knockout. He could lose his first four fights by knockout. Like, it's really as simple as that.
I'll say over under 90% Brito in this one.
I'll say under.
You're going to say under? It's slightly over. 235 votes for those tried and true Tapology fans. The 92% that have Brito, 70% by knockout for the 8% that have Alexander, 39% by decision, 44% by knockout. I think Joe Anderson Brito is going to have success in closing the range. It's just, can Alexander open up, find his range, throw his kicks, and then those long-range, odd-angle punches that he has? He could really stifle a guy like Brito. Bill Algeo was able to have success on the feet against Brito, so the game plan is there if he can stuff some of the takedowns as well. But I think Brito is going to have success with his aggression and his takedowns, and I think you're going to have a Brito win here this weekend.
If Alexander can halt some of the forward pressure up Brito, then maybe he can have success with some of his kicks and with some of his open-range striking. I still think that's going to be the case. I think Brito's going to be able to explode into range quite a bit in this matchup. Now, will he be able to get a finish? That's really hard to predict, but I really do like his power punches on the inside, especially against a longer, rangier guy who I think might even struggle at that range once Brito is able to get on the inside of his punches and his kicks. So I think Joe Anderson should be able to put on a really good showcase this weekend.
Brito is getting ready for kickboxer Melzik Bagdasarian. Now he gets a striker in Lucas Alexander. Both of us going with Brazil's Joe Anderson Brito to get the win in the matchup. Let us know, because again, this one's on really short notice. We want to hear from you in the comments section. Maybe you saw something out of the tape study when you were watching Lucas Alexander that we didn't pick up on. We'd love to hear from you either way. Keep the comments flowing. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. start this video out in a different way than we normally start our Fight Night Picks videos, with a very, very short story. So hear me out. When we were kids, Matt used to sing the chorus of a song by The Police that I feel like he only ever heard one time. And it was called Spirits in the Material World. Do you remember that, Matt?
I don't.
We have spirits in the material world. Well, when you focus on that song, a couple of guys that are spirits in the material world that exist in the UFC's bantamweight division, we have Mana Boy, Mana Martinez, coming off of an insane fight against Ronnie Lawrence's last time out, against 2-6 UFC fighter in his second stint with the promotion, D'Iberville, Mississippi's own Brandon Davis. And it's more than the 2-6, but for both of these guys, they're well outside the rankings. This fight doesn't have a lot of divisional importance, but it does have a lot of importance to the guys sticking power inside of the UFC's octagon. For Mana Martinez, this is a guy that was a Fury FC champion. And that's a division that's held a lot of weight and water in the recent memory. And if you look at it, picks up a giant win over Jose Johnson, who's now in the UFC after his second time on Dana White's Contender Series. We broke down his fight on the channel this summer. For Martinez, though, this guy's boxing combinations are insane. He switches stances a lot, sometimes for worse than for better. But for Martinez, mixes in his power shots very well. He can be a very, very fast starter, so cardio was always a question, but in his UFC debut, picks up a win by split decision over the hottest 42-year-old in this division's history, Guido Canetti, a guy who's 2-0 this year. But he wins that fight by split, and there are a lot of extenuating circumstances around that UFC debut. Mana Martinez's longtime coach, Saul Solis, had just passed, like, what was it, a week or two before the fight. He had a lot of weight to carry, and I don't say that, you know, in the like trying to make fun of it, but he actually did struggle to make weight for that matchup. And in that one, Martinez really was fighting from behind as it went on. He's able to get the win. He's able to pull it out. And then his last time against Ronnie Lawrence, he struggles. He gets dropped in the second round. He gets dropped early. But my God, did he ever come back in that third round? He looked great.
And that was really nice to see from a guy who normally was sort of a bit of a front runner in a lot of these fights. And against a guy like Brandon Davis, that's one of the first questions you have to ask yourself is, okay, am I going to still be a fresh fighter in the third round? Because if you're not able to get Brandon Davis out of there, he tends to fight at a very similar pace in that first round. He does in the second, he does in the third. But with Davis, it's interesting. There seems to be two different kind of mindsets that you can have if you're an MMA fighter. You can either, in the third and second round, when you get tired, fight in a different way, get away from your kicks, maybe wrestle a little bit less. Or when you're at full power, you might have a few more holes in your game, but you fight at a much better pace and you fight like yourself when you still get tired. And that's what Brandon Davis is. Is Brandon Davis the best fighter in the first round? No, not at all. But if you are able to get past that first 5 minute, or if he's able to get past that first 5 minute round, he does tend to pressure his opponents quite a bit. It's always very interesting to see how his opponents deal with the pressure that Brandon Davis brings, because there is two different versions of Davis. There's the aggressive version who throws a lot of punches. He's very aggressive, goes to the body, goes to the head. And then there's the version who can be, he just sort of waits a little bit. Now, I do feel like Davis has switched that mentality quite a bit, but his last performance, he was aggressive. He was going out there to try to get the win, but Dana Bakary really started putting power punches on him.
I mean, I'm going to zig just quickly.
He was hitting him, and then Bakary closed the distance, and boom, it was over.
Yeah, like, Davis almost did a little bit of a shoulder roll, hands down, gets hit by a right hand, and then shakes it off. The fight continues to wear on. Bakary's figuring out his power punching range. Bakary lands on him, and then he just goes ham. Like, he would not stop.
And you would think that against a guy like Bakary, not that Brandon Davis was going to win that fight 10 times in 10 or anything like that, but you thought that was a good matchup for Brandon Davis. It was going to be a competitive fight that was going to go late, and we're going to see who the better striker was between those guys, because they both have their differences, but they are kind of similar fighters. I just didn't like the version of Brandon Davis we saw in that fight. Now, to be fair, that was only 2 minutes, and we might see a much better version the next time. It's just, after a year off, I thought maybe we would have seen him in the cage one more time against somebody like Amanda Martinez, for instance. Just someone on that Brandon Davis level. But it is a little bit concerning to see that he's been out for this long. Davis isn't the youngest guy at this weight division either. And he has taken a little bit of damage at this point in his career, to where I'm a little worried, okay, is Brandon Davis durable enough to stand in the pocket and really be able to use his own skill set to the fullest of his potential? Because for Brandon Davis to go out there and win a fight, he's going to have to eat a couple shots to win that fight, because he does stand in the pocket quite a bit. So I'm very very interested to see if Davis is going to be comfortable eating some of the power shots that Martinez is going to throw back his way.
And I'm eager to see as well, because Romano Martinez, I touched on it at the start, he will switch stances a lot, but he's not like the type of guy that switches from orthodox to southpaw to throw one leg kick to kind of switch things up a little bit, go back to orthodox, and then continue to unleash with his boxing combinations. He just kind of switches and then switches back, and he'll switch back and forth defensively and offensively, but it doesn't really tend to accomplish a lot. So I'm eager to see. He's been with James Krause. He's had Glory MMA and Fitness as a corner his last couple of fights. I'm eager to see what we get out of him, because the pre-UFC scouting report was Mono Martinez, explosive striker, struggles against the takedowns. And we saw that against Ronnie Lawrence and against Draco Rodriguez on Contender Series. 7 of 8 takedowns against in those two fights. Mana's on his back, and he's struggling to get back up. So that's why the takedown defense is so porous. Oh, but yeah, how can he cut angles against a guy like Brandon Davis? Davis isn't Dominic Cruz in this division. He doesn't have the best footwork that we've ever seen. It's good, and it works for his boxing style. But will Martinez be able to cut things off, implement his own power shots, mix head to body, and then throw like the great left hand that he has to knock out guys like Jose Johnson? And for Davis, you touched on it. I mean, level of competition first round, wild. Like, losses to Zabit, Enrique Barzola, who's doing the damn thing over with Bellator. Zabit, Magomed Sharipov, Chikadze. Like, I might have kind of overdone myself there. He had a fight of the night against Steven Peterson. But for Davis, I mean, does he stick around late? That would be the way that he wins his fight, really.
Basically, but both guys do have complementary skill sets. I don't expect a lot of takedowns gone for on either side of this matchup. If either guy does go for a takedown, I would honestly expect it to be Brandon Davis. Not that he's the best wrestler by any means, but he has shown the ability to at least mix it in his fights, to switch up his opponents so they just don't think, okay, I'm only in a striking battle right now. So maybe Davis can use some of his wrestling to his benefit. I just think on the feet, if Davis isn't at 100% to where he can eat the power shots early, he can use his cardio and really weaponize it late, I think this is a difficult stylistic matchup for Brandon Davis, because I do see him eating a lot of power shots throughout this fight. So if he can sustain some of those power shots, and if he can eat the power of Martinez, then maybe, again, Davis can make this an interesting fight late. I just think those first 5 minutes are going to be very interesting for Brandon Davis.
If you look at it, Davis 2-5 in his original UFC run. He won 4 fights in a row outside of the promotion from 2020 to 2021, and then his last time out about a year ago, he got knocked out by Bakary Dana. We have a look at the odds here. They open a par. Mono Martinez, -160 right now. Brandon Davis, +140. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Surprise to us as they are to you. Brandon Davis has fought some names, and Mono Martinez is not. But I'm still going to say over under 70% Martinez.
I'll say over.
And it is over. 1,349 total votes. 78% Martinez. 39% by decision, 54% by knockout for the 22% that have Davis, 58% by decision, and 19% by knockout. Matt, can Mono Boy get the win, bring it back to Texas?
Just so everyone knows, I wanted this to be on the fight of the night screen. Like, that's just how good of a fight I think this is going to be. Again, not because I think either guy's the most skilled in the world. I just think their skill sets are going to make for a very fun fight. We're going to see a lot of boxing. I think we're going to see a lot of very clean shots landed on both sides. I think Mano Martinez has the slightly heavier hands. I think those are going to win out. If both guys have about the same boxing technique, which I do believe they do, I think Davis might be a little bit more technical, but Martinez has a little bit more power. I am going to ever so slightly favor Martinez. But again, I really do think this could be a fun fight to watch.
If you want to hit that bingo dabber on the card, we're going to find out who's the true king of pain in this matchup with the police references. I also have Mono Martinez here. I love the mixing of the boxing combinations, picking the power shots, and that lead hand, whether it's the right or the left, really does win out for Mono Martinez, and I think he can catch Davis on the back foot. So for me, I do have Martinez. You might have Brandon Davis in the matchup. The guy is a cardio king. So let us know down below in the comments section who you have here at Bantamweight. Some big-time fights left on this card. I'm excited for Misha Cirkunov, Alonzo Menafield. You're not going to want to miss that. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it.
That crucifix position is just murder. And it looked like Mo Zorov is upset about something.
Big time matchup at light heavyweight coming up this weekend. We have Latvia and Canada's own Misha Cirkunov taking on Atomic Alonzo Menafield, a man whose last matchup can be summed up in a meme when he took on Askar Mazarov. And if you look at it for Alonzo Menafield, like, I don't know, he made up like a character in his head of what Mazarov was, and then he went out there and destroyed him. And those Those elbows from the mounted crucifix position were absolutely insane. A lot of people thought Makhachev was going to be a force in the division for a long time, and then one fight, see you later.
Next question.
See ya. But if you do look at it for Alonzo Menafield, only 12-3. You'd think he's a young guy. He's 34. What? It seems like he's been around for a long time. He kind of has. I mean, his first UFC fight was against a guy who never picked up a UFC win, in Vinicius Moeia. But if you look at it for Menafield, some interesting wins. Obviously, the Paul Craig win's a one that's really top of mind for a lot of people. But he trains out of Janjira Muay Thai. Not the biggest gym, but a main training partner is Chidi Njokuani. So for Menafield, he really can mix it up with his game. You look at a fight that's kind of similar to the one that he has in front of him against Misha Cirkunov, and that would probably be his fight where a father just yelled at his son for 15 straight minutes when he took on Devin Clark. And in that matchup, Menafield had some success in the striking, got held up against the cage for the majority of the fight. Clark was able to win out in that fight. But for Menafield, when it's going good, it's good. When it's going bad, it's bad, and he's really fighting from behind, it seems, in his losses.
If Misha Cirkunov heard that sentence, he'd be like, boy, you're telling me. Here's the thing about Cirkunov. This fight really comes down to how much left does Cirkunov have? Like,
of his left bicep or just in general?
Just in general in his MMA career. Like, I brought this up a lot when Dan Hooker fought Arnold Allen. I put a decent amount of money on that fight too, and this is why. Because I hate it when people move weight classes at the end of their careers and do it way too much. Like, with Dan Hooker, it was, I can't make 145 anymore. Moves up to 155, looks really good. Runs into some hard fights just because that's the way MMA is. You can do everything right and you can still lose. And then decided, oh, I'm now going to go back to the weight class that I had trouble in originally. Misha Cirkunov, later into his career, decided, hey, I'm going to cut a bunch of weight to go down to the middleweight division. A 20-pound weight difference, I might add. It's not like this is a minor weight difference where, oh, we only cut 4 extra pounds like we're in boxing. Misha Cirkunov had to lose an extra 20 pounds to make middleweight. Had a Misha Cirkunov performance, you know, didn't look good in the striking, went for a lot of takedowns, that was about it. Loses that fight, and then immediately goes, what if I move back up to light heavyweight? For Cirkunov, I don't know why he has been doing all these weight class jumps, because he would have had the exact same results if he had just stayed at this weight class. Like, you're telling me Misha Cirkunov couldn't have lost or had a competitive unanimous decision with name any unranked fighter in this weight class, and then still fought Alonzo Menafield next? I don't really know where Misha is in his MMA career. Do you think Misha Cirkunov wakes up every day and goes, hey, I'm going to be UFC champion? Like, he's 35 years old. And I'm sure to a certain degree he does. But at a certain point, you're 1-4 in your last 5, and you have been jumping around weight classes quite a bit. Well, I understand that the strong skill set is still there. Misha Cirkunov gets up Grizzly Bear to the mat. He's going to be trouble for him on top with his submissions. I don't love the regression of striking that we've seen in Misha Cirkunov. I don't love the gas tank we've seen of Cirkunov. And I really do think that at this stage of his career, he has to get the fight and do his very exact turns for him to be able to go in there and look like the Cirkunov of old.
Well, for Cirkunov, you kind of glossed over. You melted 2 fights into one. Look at it in his calendar year, the past year, he fought at middleweight and he took on Christophe Jocko. He went 5-17 on takedown attempts, but he was pretty much like glue on Jocko's back. And in the striking, he lost. It was a really close fight. It could have gone either way. Jocko ends up getting the win. He takes on Wellington Turman. He looked pretty good in that fight. He was having success with the striking. He was getting his takedowns. Technically, he did only go, 1-3 on that one? And he did get performance of the night bonused. But if you do focus on it, he had a choke in the first round that was nearly a finish until time expired. In the second round, he's winning the fight. He's landing really good stock guard, ground and pound. He goes down a little bit. He gets caught in an armbar and really quickly taps out of it. So for Cirkunov, it's an unfortunate roll of the dice his last 2 times. Moves back up to 205. And when you focus on the best Misha Cirkunov, and you want to focus on performances where, okay, how will that translate here? His fight against Jimmy Crute. Wins in the wrestling, wins in the scrambles.
Jimmy Crute initiated the wrestling, though.
Gets a crazy submission out of the Peruvian necktie. His fight against a guy like Durkin, Pat Cummins, but you never thought I'd be talking about that fight. He was able to get it down to the mat and finish it really quickly by triangle. Arm triangle was how he got it done. If you focus on Misha Cirkunov, Alonzo Menafield, Cirkunov has a judo lineage, the freestyle and Greco-Roman wrestling in his back pocket, but I do agree, like you said, can the cardio hang on, and can he strike with Alonzo Menafield? Because most people can't in this division. They struggle there.
I think it is a bigger point, though. Like, I talked about this a lot when Marcin Tybura had his last fight. I forget who it was his last time out, but Marcin Tybura at one point, not that he was a world-class striker, but was thought of as a guy that you had to respect on the feet, and then he had the grappling to go along with it that really was his X factor. Sergeyev at one point was respectable enough on the feet, but I feel like his striking has regressed over time to where we now know what Misha Sergeyev is going to do. Alonzo Menafield knows, okay, this guy's not really striking with me at any point throughout this fight, and if he is striking with me, it's really only going to be to set up that takedown. Now, again, to be fair to Sergeyev, if he gets one good takedown on pretty much anybody in the weight class, and that's where that Jimmy Crute win comes into effect. And that's where it's a great win, but it's not the best of wins. Like, Misha Sergeyev was the one who went out there, power double-legged him, got onto his back, and then got him with a Peruvian necktie. That would be as good of a win as you could possibly get. Jimmy Crute was the one who initiated that grappling, though, and who helped Sergeyev get that to the mat. And that's why I do think Sergeyev is going to have a hard time getting Menafield down, which is his natural wrestling defense, wrestling offense. And the thing about Menafield, too, is, everyone's going to know this, he does have pretty good strikes out of the clinch for defending the takedown, too. He's someone who is going to try to damage you over time in some of those positions. It's going to be one of those fights where Menafield's going to look great until he doesn't, or maybe Sergeyev can go out there and pull off a huge upset.
So I'll mention the odds and why I'm not a huge fan of them. Menafield open minus 160 is a minus 220. Sergeyev open plus 140, plus 175. Alonzo Menafield in his last two losses, Devin Clark gets held against the cage, defending the takedowns, his fight against William Knight, defending takedowns, and he's held around. And that's how he loses those fights. Can Sergeyev do what William Knight did? Well, yeah, he can. 100% he can do that. Now, for Misha Sergeyev, there was a period of time. Us Canadians get excited about some of these fighters. He went 4-0 to start his UFC career. He was finishing guys. It looked like it was going to be top of the mountain. Since he went 4-0, he's 2-6. So he's 6-6 overall in the UFC. It hasn't been the greatest run of late for the guy out of Extreme Couture. He spent that time at Extreme Couture Etobicoke and then went to Vegas, Drysdale, BJJ. He's kind of been all around the map lately training. But we have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprised us there to you. And again, I don't have a good read on the odds, so I'm not going to have a great read on the Tapology votes. I'm going to throw a dart in the dark. I'm going to say over under 70% Menafield.
I think it'll be over. I think it'll be a huge fit. Yeah.
1,414 total votes, 88% Menafield, 86% by knockout for the 12% that have Sergeyev, 45% by submission. I've seen Menafield held and struggle with a lot of the grappling and the wrestling against some other opponents. It's just, can Misha Sergeyev do that one more time? Will we see that glimmer of Sergeyev in this fight? That's the thing that I don't know.
I think this is a really difficult fight for Misha Sergeyev, I'm being completely honest with you. He had a physicality advantage over a lot of guys in his first little run, like you had mentioned, when people thought he was a legitimate contender. He's not going to have that on Alonzo Menafield, who is a massive 205-er. Like, he's a really big light heavyweight. And also, I just think Menafield's the much more damaging striker in this matchup. If Sergeyev's not able to get that takedown, and especially early, I think he's going to be eating a lot of damage shots throughout this fight. Like, here's the thing. He was the golden goose, if you will, for Canadian MMA for the light heavyweight division. I know that's a very specific category to be in, but again, he was a very hyped up fighter. You don't go from being one of the most hyped up 205ers to looking good against Wellington Turmon and having two guys talk about it on the internet, and you still lose that fight. Like, Wellington's not a great fighter.
Like, think of other 205ers in Canadian history. Like, everybody was excited when Ryan Jimmo finished Anthony Parash out in Alberta, but we haven't had a lot of big 205 contenders. It's not a thing.
And I don't think Misha Sergeyev's coming back up from 185 pounds to beat Alonzo Menafield.
I think Alonzo Menafield has that striking advantage. He's not going to be able to just shoot across the cage like he did in his last fight and easily take down, I think his name's Askar Mazharov. I think
no
his
one
record's
knows anymore.
17 and 13. I don't know. Nevada State Athletic Commission wasn't very happy with him. But for both of us, going with Atomic Alonzo Menafield, will it be the return of the Moxie? I've been drinking soda this morning getting ready for the show for Misha Sergeyev, or will it be Atomic Menafield getting the win? You let us know down below in the comment section. Some big fights left on this card, including Cub Swanson, Jonathan Martinez. I can't wait for it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Coming up this weekend at middleweight, if this fight goes to a decision, I'll dye my hair blue for next weekend's videos. Will you do the same?
I'll go platinum blonde. I'll do like the Charles Oliveira.
All right, because if you combine the records of both of these men, Jordan Wright is 12-3 with no contest. Dusko Todorovic is 11-3. You combine them, two decision wins between both of them, but really, they're both decision, or sorry, two fights, just in general, that have gone to decision. They're both for Disco Todorovic. It's absolutely wild.
Do you think before this fight, Jordan Rice is going to be crying in his locker room, just going, let me bang, bro.
I mean, want to bang. The guy likes to first-round bang. That's the craziest part about it. For Jordan Wright, he's never seen the third round in all, 16 of his fights, and he's only ever seen the second round twice, and so that's kind of wild. Dana White's Contender Series and in the UFC, Wright is 2-3 with a no contest, but the no contest for Anthony Fluffy Hernandez was due to the jazz cabbage. He was floating that green
and
stuff.
And I don't care. I gotta be honest about that.
No. So that was the loss. He lost by finish.
Wait, do America... Like, that's what I don't get. Like, do people in other parts of the world care about this way more than we do?
I think some Southeast Asian countries definitely
That's care. Fair. Again, this is something that doesn't come up in MMA all that often, but drug tests or failed drug tests do happen. As a Canadian... You guys probably know this. I don't care if you fail for weed at all. It doesn't help anybody become better at MMA fights. It's just, I never think about that, though, because I'm sure there's people out there who are like, oh my goodness, that's like a terrible PED.
Yeah, it is. And in lots of places in the world, it is. Canada's just very relaxed on those things. But when we bring it back into this fight, both these guys are finishers to the nth degree. And for Jordan Wright, you see it in his style. He does have a karate background. And he's a guy that right after high school, fresh out, went to Jackson Wink, tried out to be in the pro program. Ended up at Jackson Wink for a really long time, training with, and I'll throw the picture up there, like a baby-faced John Jones. And it's a great way to get ready to get yourself to the UFC, since switched over to Dynamics MMA in California with Anthony Hardonk and Vladimir Matyushenko. The successes of those two guys haven't boiled down into Jordan Wright, but... the wildness is definitely there. And for Wright, his last time out against Marc-Andre Barrio, I don't know why he tried to, like, flip the scales on him, because he went for a takedown, wouldn't give it up, got his head kind of locked into the side position. Barrio cranks on the guillotine, then reverses it, gets on top, and it's a mounted guillotine win for Barrio. But really played into the hands of the Canadian, where Jordan Wright, if he's going to win, he has a lot of success when he stands and bangs. It's also like an Achilles heel, but that is where he finds most of his success. And that's what makes this fight so much fun, because for Disco, we know how good of a ground fighter he is as well, but sometimes he doesn't like to employ his wrestling and he likes to bang.
Exactly. Like, there's a version of Disco out there who fights like Chad Mendes. Now, of course, he doesn't have the wrestling background of a guy like Mendes, but you get the idea. He's going to box his way into his wrestling exchanges. Then he's going to use both parts of those games to help complement the other. But we really have just seen the swing and bang version of Disco throughout a lot of his UFC tenure up until this point. And it has been good, don't get me wrong. But the problem is, when you fight like Justin Gaethje, you better be able to take a punch like Justin Gaethje. Like, that's pretty much the rule for being a brawler. And for Disco, he has been wobbled in pretty much every single one of his UFC fights up until this point, and that does make you pretty nervous when he's fighting basically anybody in the middleweight division, and especially somebody who has the heavy hands of Jordan Wright. But this is another one of those fights. I mentioned it earlier with Manny Martinez, Brandon Davis. The winner of this isn't then going to go on to fight for a title, but this fight's going to be awesome for as long as it lasts. I really think it will be. Well, if Disco goes out there, rushes for it with combinations, and just meets the power punching of Jordan Wright, like, this is going to be an awesome fight.
Jordan Wright has the requisite 5 fights under his UFC belt to be included in the all-time UFC statistical rankings, and I'm going to throw it up there on the screen. He is ranked in the top 5 category for the amount of strikes that the guy throws, but also how quick his fights end. Like, they are over very, very quickly.
And those aren't always in a positive light, you know? No.
And again, he has a well-rounded background, does Jordan Wright. For Disco, black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and a black belt in Taekwondo. So he's kind of like Anthony Pettis and Benson Henderson, only he doesn't really fight like Anthony Pettis or Benson Henderson. His best win for the fighter out of Serbia is his win over Michel Pereira, where he backs him up against the cage and unloads and wins the Serbian Battle Championship middleweight title. Comes into the UFC, well, even before that, had a brief fight against Teddy Ash on Contender Series. Wins there, picks up a performance bonus over Daquan Townsend, where he ends up getting him down to the mat on top and mounts him and finishes him with ground and pound. But since then, murky waters for Todorovic. Lose to Puna Soriano, gets finished. Lose to Gregory Rodriguez by decision. Beats Maki Bitolo by finish, who's picked up a couple of wins outside of the octagon. And lose to Chidi Njokuani with one of the most hellacious elbows you're ever going to see. So for both of these guys, big time bangers. We have a look at the odds. Disco opened a -155. He's a -202. Jordan Reid open a plus 135, plus 166. I see this one closer to even.
I was just about to say, I've never said I love the odds on Jordan Reid before, but, like, those aren't that bad.
Oh, people are going to tee-hee in the comments section on the plane listening to the podcast. We'll have a look at the Tapology vote. I'm not going to leave it up to surprise. 1,345 total votes, 74% Todorovic. You've got 79% by knockout for the 26% that I've right, 77% by knockout. Either guy could get the knockout. It's a fight that I would anticipate finishes, and I bet the odds, like, you wouldn't even touch them anyway.
Two guys who are on either day can look really good and on either day look really bad. The difference is, Dusko can look really good fight to fight or really bad fight to fight. Jordan Reid can look really good or really bad minute to minute. And that's what really does concern me in a matchup like this against Dusko. Let's say Dusko does use his wrestling to at least close the distance and just get closer to Jordan Reid. I think that could be a great way to actually open up with some of his combinations, just as a way so that Reid can't effectively counter him on the way in. So I'm with the wrestling a little bit, go in for the hips, use your combinations to go back up top. I think the body shots for Dusko are going to be really key in this fight as well, because Jordan Reid is someone who stands very upright. That body should be wide open for Dusko if he does decide to go to the body with some of those hooks. Again, not something Dusko always does, but when he does go to the body with his combinations, they're always very effective. Again, this fight is as one or the other as you can possibly get. It is water and oil. There's not much of a mix at all. I kind of like the odds for Jordan Reid, if I'm being completely honest, because I like the size. I like the range that he does have in this weight class, but like I just said, I sort of talked myself into the Dusko pick. I think if Todorovic can get on the inside, I don't know if Reid has an answer in that, like, elbow range. And I think that's where Dusko's going to get a lot of his own work done at. So again, this is a fight where either I get knocked out in the first minute of it or the last minute of it. But I'm ever so slightly picking Dusko.
I've seen more out of Dusko. I've seen more fights. Well, I've seen two go to decision. I've seen more third rounds. But I do favor his style. I mean, again, his fight against Teddy Ash, is the third round a lot of fun? Not really. He kind of holds Teddy Ash up against the cage, and that's pretty much that. But for Dusko, I've seen the wrestling chops. Now, for Jordan Reid, he did get a couple of takedowns against Marc-Andre Barrio at the start of that fight, and you like to see that turn of the corner. Maybe I'm not going to be as much stand and bang. Maybe I'm going to mix my martial arts. I think that plays more into his opponent's game plan in this matchup. If Reid decides to put the wrestling shoes on, Dusko does have some counters to that as well. So for me, I'll go with the fighter out of Serbia. We're in agreement on that one, but do like the odds for the underdog in this matchup. And usually on these cards, I go with a couple of wacky underdogs, and this one really isn't one of them, but both of us siding with Dusko in the matchup. Let us know down below in the comments section. Will you also dye your hair if this one goes to a decision? It would be absolutely wild.
If I tweet at Charles Oliveira with my hair as long as it is, like, bright blonde, I better get a retweet or something.
We'll see what happens. Coming up this weekend, some big time fights on this card. Grasso, Araujo in the main event. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Big time pairing at flyweight as the former ACB 125-pound champ Askar Askarov looks to avenge his first career loss in his last time out. He's going to be taking on a guy who's probably a big fan of Russell Tyrone Jones in Raw Dog Brandon Royval. And Matt, for Brandon Royval, I think the craziest thing that jumps off of the page is he's had three UFC fight in the night bonuses, and all three of those fights did not go three rounds. He had two-rounders, and his last time out, he fights Matt Schnell. And boy, oh boy, was that a wild one, with Schnell knocking him down and then getting submitted. Like, it was absolute insanity. Royval's had a crazy fight against Kai Kara France. He's just been all over the map. And when you think of the Fight Night Picks way to kind of cap a fight and try and figure out who's going to win, usually I go with, okay, who's got more avenues to finishing the fight? Brandon Royval is one of those guys that can get it done in any different aspect of the game. Now, what's his Achilles heel? Well, he struggles with defending the takedowns, which Askar Askarov excels at. I mean, he's an international master of sports in freestyle wrestling and master of sport in combat sambo. That's where his bread gets buttered. He has a twister win over with ACB. He really does get it done that way. But when I tried to think of it, just again, in my mind's eye, how do these guys get wins? I thought, okay, well, Brandon Royval, most likely to get a finish. But if you actually look at it, numbers on a page, 11 of Askarov's 14 wins are by finish. For Royval, 12 of his 14 wins are by finish. So it's very close.
The thing is, against who have they finished?
Royval's still been getting them finished in the UFC, whereas Askarov's been winning by decision. However, They have been impressive wins by decision.
They definitely have been, don't get me wrong. But if this fight ends inside the distance, it's either going to be because Askar Askarov is just holding Brandon Royval down, and Royval can't get back up, and it's like a TKO that the ref just feels bad for him, or Brandon Royval stops Askar Askarov. Like, Askarov fights in a very damaging manner, don't get me wrong, but he's not someone who really overexerts himself going for the finish because he feels like it's a necessity. I always think about the Joseph Benavidez fight. The Benavidez fight was one of the most one-sided fights I've ever seen not get stopped inside the distance, and you can tell Askarov was, he wasn't threatened on the feet, he wasn't threatened with the wrestling of Benavidez, he was really able to just fight at whatever pace and whatever range that he wanted to, and you can just kind of tell, like, by the end of the third round, he's not, like, going for the TKO and charging after Benavidez, he's just taking the fight as it comes, being an intelligent fighter, and that's the real thing about Askarov. He fights in a very smart manner, and he's not someone who's going to automatically try to explode and fight like someone who he isn't all of a sudden. He doesn't have the most, and I'm not going to say he has, or he doesn't have the most aesthetically pleasing game, because he is a fun fighter to watch, but he's not going to throw anything all that unorthodox at you. It's a lot of good boxing combinations. He holds his hands high. Again, he's not wild on the feet, but he has very effective striking, and he must be very heavy-handed in the way that, like, a Tony Ferguson is, because when he lands the jab, when he lands the right hand, they might not look like they're, you know, rocking the head back of his opponent, but you just tell by the damage that happens over time. These are hard shots that are landing, and that's what's going to be really interesting to see how Brandon Royval fights this fight, because what if Royval comes out like he fought Brandon Moreno? Now, I know it didn't really work out for him against Moreno because he dislocated his arm, but against Moreno, he just went after him. Same thing with Kai Kara France. Like, he tried to blitz his opponent. Against Askarov, I'll be very interested to see if he does try to have that kind of a mindset, because it'll be interesting to see how Askarov deals with that pressure. Will he then go for the takedown? Will he be comfortable enough to strike on the feet? Because with Askarov's wrestling advantage that he has in this fight, that's the biggest advantage that either guy has in really any of the three areas of MMA, and the wrestling and the striking or the overall grappling, I think Askarov's going to be able to dictate where this fight takes place. And if that is the case, I think Royval's really going to have to be damaging off of his back. And that's a tough gameplay to have.
Well, it's tough. But the craziest part about it is you hate to see a fighter just pull guard or hold guard and try and go for submissions off their back. Brandon Royval, though, even when he's rocked, he's able to pull off some of these submissions. Moving. And it's wild. He's always doing something. So for Askarov, again, we touched on it. He's kind of a picture of efficiency. Yeah. Does that jump off the page? Does that sell pay-per-views? No, that's why he's on a fight night card and he's a top-ranked flyweight. But for Askarov, this is the line. Took down Brandon Moreno 4 times. Took down Pantoja 2 times. Took down Joseph Benavidez 5 times. Took down Kai Kara France 2 times. Now, he loses that fight to Kai Kara France, and that was essentially a title eliminator because Kara France then gets the fight against Moreno, gets finished by the body kick. If you do look at it, though, we touched on this in the open to the show. Both of these guys are either fighting with a rematch with Kai Kara France, or a rematch with Alessandro Pantoja. Now, for Pantoja, he is listed and talked about as the alternate to the 4th installment of Figueiredo and Moreno. So, ultimately, you win this matchup this weekend, you're on the shelf for, like, 8 months.
It'd be difficult to do a Royval Pantoja rematch, I would think. That would be fair, just because it ended so quick in the first round. I think maybe you'd give Royval the loser of that fight between Moreno.
For me, again, you touched on it. Askarov, he definitely has some more technical boxing. He can keep the pace for all 3 rounds. Kind of struggled a little bit against Kai Kara France, we're all being honest with each other, so we'll see how that goes in this fight on the rebound from his first career loss. But for Askarov, he does have that picture of efficiency. Ken Mixon has takedowns. For Royval, taken down 4 times by Tim Elliott, 2 times by Moreno, 3 times by Pantoja, 8 times by Bonturin. Is he losing all of those fights? Not necessarily, but he does struggle with the takedown defense. But the thing that I like out of Brandon Royval, the body kick, the southpaw look, yeah. And it's always going to be open, and it's a big weapon that he utilizes to slow down his opponents, even in these 1 and 2 round fights. He's able to really kind of damage with the body kick to start the fight, open up with his hands. Obviously, like we've seen his spinning back fist, his flying knees, the Kai Kara France fight as the big example. But I go down through this one, Matt, and I'm not to say that I'm leaning Brandon Royval, but again, I touched on it. He has more methods of victory.
This is the problem with Royval, though, that I have in this matchup. He's a better striker than Askar Askarov, but not in the way that you would probably think. Like, Askar Askarov is a good striker. I'm not taking that away from him. He's slower than molasses on a cold winter's day, to quote our great-grandmother, but he is an effective striker who has very good basic combinations. Royval's a good striker, but he's not basic at all. He is not the big fundamental. Him and Tim Duncan don't have a lot in common. I think the fact that he is so unorthodox on the feet is going to hurt him. I think the fact that he has to turn his back to throw some of those spinning techniques, he has to overextend himself in pursuit of offense on the feet, is going to then open up the takedowns from Askar Askarov. And not that I don't think Royval can at least hang with him on the mat for a few different exchanges, I just don't think he's going to win the fight off of his back. You can fight really well off your back, throw elbows, and threaten with submissions, but unless you actually get one of those submissions, the guy on top landing ground and pound is probably the one who's going to win a lot of those rounds, and that's what I see happening in this fight for the most part. But I do see out of the corner of my eye you holding my favorite album of all time.
Well, we'll see if Brandon Royval can come out like April Wine and hit it harder and faster. I mean, look at those guys in the back. Look at Miles. Look at that guy.
Just... if you guys don't know April Wine, please give him a listen.
I mean, Canada's greatest. And
just between you and me.
Miles is from Woodstock, New Brunswick, Canada. Great province, Matt. We have a look at the odds in this matchup. They're basically where they opened. Askarov at a minus 250. Brandon Royval at a plus 210, plus 200 or thereabout. We have a look at the votes in the YouTube community tab, because we threw this one out there not that long ago. You folks get the opportunity to fill out that poll, and if you drop a comment, we will read it on the show. So, Thanksgiving taping of UFC Vegas 62. It's Thanksgiving in Canada. Who's going to get the win? 674 total votes, 70% Askarov. Florida man says brain says Askarov, heart says raw dog. I'm with you, Florida man. Bill is saying Royval's game plan is to wrestle, and I don't see Royval being able to get repeat takedowns, keep top pressure over Askarov. I think it's going to be a stand-up fight, and Askarov is a better striker, so I have to go with Askarov. In a bizarro world, maybe, because I see it as the opposite myself. Benjamin's saying I got Askar for the win, and we also have, who else? Prince Vegeta's son saying Bryce Mitchell. I don't know why. You're here every week. You're saying Bryce Mitchell. Matt, when we do focus in on this one, Askarov's the favorite. Again, steady Eddie on the feet and on the mat. Who do you have to win the fight?
I agree with everything we've said about Royval. I think he does have the higher highs, if you will. I just think the lows are a lot lower, and that's the thing. I think he is going to struggle with a lot of the takedown attempts of Askar Askarov, and I think this could be one of the best fights on the card. The problem is, I don't think Askar Askarov is going to fight in a manner that makes this one of the best fights in the card. I really do think he's going to rely a lot on his wrestling, a lot on that top pressure. Again, not that Royval can't have success in this matchup. I've just seen him struggle with what Askar Askarov does well too many times up until this point. So that's why I have Askarov, but it should be a fun fight.
When it gets to the upper echelon of these things, again, this one can be hard to break down. Okay. I know 70% of you have Askarov, 30% have Royval. In the back of my mind, I want to go with that sexy underdog pick of Brandon Royval, but when you get to the top of the top, when you have a steady Eddie that's very well rounded, I mean, think of those types of fighters that either become champion or hang around near the top, where you're a high flyer, you're a high roller, you can sometimes get it done and mash buttons to get all the way up to the top, but the style isn't conducive to sticking around.
Think about Colby Covington, Marvin Vettori. Like, there's guys like Askar Askarov in other divisions who are near the top,
and they just kind of put out the fire. So for me, I do have Askarov here, thinking that he's going to rebound off his first professional loss. Let us know down in the comment section. You disagree with us, you do have Ooh Baby I Like It Raw out of ODB, you've got Brandon Royval. This should be a great fight. Co-main event, Cub Swanson's taking on Jonathan Martinez. It's a great fight. And in the main event, top build flyweights, we have Alexa Grasso and Viviane Araújo. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. 2022 UFC Hall of Famer, WEC and UFC legend Cub Swanson looking to throw back and throw down, taking on the Dragon Jonathan Martinez coming up this weekend. And this is kind of the craziest part about it. I'm not going to say what weight class it's at. You can probably already tell. Well, Jonathan Martinez, he struggled in the past with his weight. Probably going to be at featherweight, right? Nope. Cub Swanson's about a month away from his 39th birthday. And listen, we're talking about a guy that's going for his 41st pro fight. Now he's moving down to bantamweight. So unless there's a big time change throughout this week and it gets scratched and they throw it at 145, this one's scheduled for bantamweight. And I think that's absolutely an insane move for Cub Swanson, considering the fact that he just beat Darren Elkins in impressive fashion, a performance tonight bonus at 145. Obviously, we know about the high highs, the low lows, the four-fight losing streak that he was on before this now 3-1 record in his last four fights. For Swanson, though, it is a little bit of a head-scratcher. I assume you see some of the success late career, I mean, or at least guys that have thrown it down to 135, like Frankie Edgar, Jose Aldo, and, you know, some of the success that Dominic Cruz has had. And he's seen those guys move down the 10 pounds and still look halfway fresh. That's why he's moving down. But it really is a head scratcher for me why Swanson would make the move to bantamweight.
It's not the same, though, is the problem. Like, what Cub Swanson's doing is way worse than what those guys did. People forget, Jose Aldo's like 34 years old, by the way. Like, Jose Aldo...
36 now.
My point is, when Jose Aldo moved from featherweight to bantamweight, he was like 31, 32. He wasn't old at all in his MMA... He was old in his MMA career. But physically, he wasn't an old person. Frankie Edgar went from lightweight, moved down to featherweight and bantamweight before he got to his 40s. Now, the move down to bantamweight was quite late into his career, but still, he was like that 35, 36. I hate the fact that Cub Swanson's moving down to bantamweight for this fight, and I really like how you opened up this video, because I agree. I really thought upon first view of this matchup that, okay, it's going to be a featherweight. Martinez is finally competing in the weight class that I've always felt suited him the best, but that's not the case. And this is what I keep on going back to. Not that Jonathan Martinez is as good as Giga Chikadze, because that's not the truth whatsoever. But do they fight in a similar manner? Yes, they do. They're very similar. They're both very good kickboxers on the outside who throw a lot of kicks. Can Cub Swanson eat a body kick at 145? Not great. So now you're telling me the guy's older and he's taking more weight off of himself and he's fighting another guy who goes for a lot of body attacks. Again, that's just a very bare bones game of what how I think this fight could go. It's just, I don't love the fact that the last time I've seen a guy get TKO'd, it was due to a body shot. Now he's fighting a guy who throws a lot of kicks to the body, goes to the body quite a bit, and he's taking another 10 pounds off himself, because I really do think that's key.
Well, I mean, and you can focus in on it if you do look at Jonathan Martinez. The wins are good. The level of competition in those wins, not great. I mean, obviously, the biggest one that jumps off the page is a guy who everybody thought was going to be something, and Thomas Almeida. And it was a fun fight at 145. It really was. But again, the last three wins for Martinez, he looked really good against Vince Morales his last time out. That was back in May. And in that matchup, I mean, it was at bantamweight. He was able to make the limit. He was a pretty big favorite. Minus 270 was Martinez. But Alejandro Perez, where he gets dropped in the first round at the end of it, he rallies back round two, round three. Even one of the judges scored the first round for him because he won the round. It was just, does a knockdown and damage outweigh a really good round? He beats Ziad Lazisvili, who came in on short notice and then got cut. Lose to Davy Grant, pretty good boxer, using his hooks.
And that's the thing too, Jonathan Martinez, for the highs that I like to bring up, he does struggle with some of the boxing, or not even the boxing, the range closing of some of his opponents, and that's what Cub Swanson is really good at doing. He can lunge, he can jump, he's really unorthodox that way.
And the best part for Cub Swanson, he switched up his style his last time out. Like, he held his hands incredibly low against Darren Elkins, but he had the really odd angle punches. Obviously, you saw the spinning wheel kick that was able to get the finish. But for Swanson, we touched on it. I mean, the four-fight losing streak that he did have, he had crazy win streaks from 2012 until 2014. George Roop, Ross Pearson, Charles Oliveira, Dustin Poirier, Dennis Seaver, and Jeremy Stephens. Then he loses to Frankie Edgar and Max Holloway back-to-back. Then he beats Hakran Diaz. He beats, who else? Kawajiri, Duho Choi, which was his Hall of Fame performance. And then Artem Lobov in a main event. If you go on Google Trends for the last, 10 years, and you search Cub Swanson, the biggest search term was when he was going into his fight against Artem Lobov. Can you believe that?
That hurts, my brain to know that. Cub Swanson deserves better, that's all.
But if you do look at it for Cub Swanson, when he faces primary strikers and when he faces primary boxers, he tends to throw a lot more leg kicks than he does in the majority of his fights. His fight against Artem Lobov and his loss to Shane Burgos are proof of that. And the weird thing about Cub Swanson when he does face primary strikers and he chooses to throw kicks, or at least primary boxers, and he throws a lot of kicks, it's not that he starts off hot and heavy with them in the first round and then kind of gets away from it as the fight goes on, as he incurs a lot of damage. He actually tends to pick up his leg kicks as the fights go on. So an interesting thing about Cub Swanson, but you touched on it. Boxing really is the specialty. He can struggle with some of the takedowns. He can struggle with some of the grappling. I go back to his fight against Jens Pulver with WEC, where he gets caught in the 10-finger guillotine.
Cub Swanson is a black belt. They're going to tell you that a lot. I've never seen Cub Swanson convincingly out-grapple somebody in an MMA fight. Now, I know he has. He hit that one sick hip toss on Dennis Seaver that I'll never forget because it was awesome. He has really good hip tosses. Like, a Cub Swanson hip toss, it's so clean, it's not even funny. But He's been submitted and controlled on the mat a lot in his MMA career. And when, like, Max Holloway goes out there and can submit you, and I know Max Holloway was, like, really putting it on him with the volume before comes Swanson away for an ill-advised takedown attempt. Just, Swanson, they are going to bring up, like, oh, he's got a black belt. But it's more Shogun than it is Damian Maia, I would say, at this point.
Well, and the other thing, Cub Swanson, for having 40 professional fights going into his 41st, from what I could find, he's only really faced a few southpaws in the last, I don't know, 15 years. Jens Paul was a southpaw. Again, he lost that fight by submission. And then Crone Gracie was a southpaw as well, where that was a wild fight of the night. And yeah, it was a lot of fun. Giga, who's apparently chopped liver to a lot of the Fight Night Picks fans now that he lost one fight to Calvin Kattar. Giga Chikadze, just see you later. Forget about you. But Matt, when you do focus in on this one, when you do look at the odds, Swanson open to plus 175, plus 165 right now. Jonathan Martinez open around a minus 205, minus 210. He's a minus 200. We threw it out there to you in the YouTube community tab. Surprise to us, it is to you. Your total votes, 53% with Cub Swanson, 47% with Jonathan Martinez. In the comments, Devin saying Jonathan's last fight was such a clean performance, and I believe if he can turn it into a similar fight, i.e. don't brawl or go punch for punch, he'll have a good chance against Cub. Chandler Witt saying 38-year-old Cub looked phenomenal his last time out against 38-year-old Elkins. 28-year-old Martinez looked phenomenal against 31-year-old Morales. Gonna have to side with youth in this one. And Matt, we'll go with Tommy saying Cub by TKO. So, Matt, the fans are kind of split on this one, the fan vote. Martinez is a pretty big favorite. Can he implement the kicks early, go to the body, go to the legs, go to the head, and get a win over Cub Swanson? Because, you know, regardless of 145 or 135, the volume's going to be there for Cub Swanson. And I talked about efficiency earlier. In terms of striking defense and offense, he's very accurate, and he doesn't receive a ton of damage. Actually, he has 60% striking defense, WEC, UFC.
He's been hit a lot, though.
Well, yeah.
I worry about Cub Swanson at 135, not only for his punch resistance, but I'm also curious to see what his punching power is going to be at this weight class, too, because Cub Swanson isn't the best power puncher, but he does have good power. I know that's a weird thing to say, but he went like 6 years without a TKO win up until the Daniel Pineda win. I'm not exactly sure who his previous knockout loss was or win was. I guess it's something we can figure out very, very fast. But for Cub Swanson, it's normally just an accumulation of his striking that really does get to his opponents before his natural power does, because he went all the way from Dennis Seaver in 2013 to Daniel Pineda, and Pineda in 2020.
Pineda burned hot in the first round of that fight and looked really good. That was Swanson coming back off of an ACL surgery. To then Swanson dropping Pineda twice in the second round, Pineda was gassed.
Swanson looked really good in that fight. I'm just saying, people think about Cub Swanson as the guy who's won his last two fights by going out there and getting a lot of stoppages. I'll give you, he's a great striker. I don't know if he's a great power puncher. And I think for that reason, I do side with Jonathan Martinez in this matchup. It's weird having a fight with Jonathan Martinez at 135 and not having the weight question mark be with Martinez, but I'm curious to see how Cub Swanson's cardio is going to hold up. I'm very curious to see what his punch resistance is going to be. And if Martinez does look like the fighter that he has been post-Davy Grant, he's a little bit more defensively sound. He's still that offensive dynamo. We all know how good his combinations are, his kicks in particular. That's why I am going to side with Jonathan Martinez, but it should be a fun co-main event.
I have Martinez, southpaw stance, opens up the body kick. It's a big specialty of his, and I'm eager to see how he's able to implement it, whether he goes teep with the front leg, and then he's able to mix it up to the three levels. I really do like the matchup. I think it's going to be a ton of fun. It's on our Fight of the Night screen for reason. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have in this matchup. You folks help drive this show. And in the main event, we have Alexa Grasso taking on Viviana Araújo. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
In the poster for this week, in the neon marquee at flyweight, we have Mexico's Alexa Grasso looking to earn her fourth straight victory, taking on Brazil's Viviane Araújo. And listen, I really do appreciate everybody that's tuned in this week. You folks have really been in the driver's seat for this show. YouTube community tab, Instagram at Fight Night Picks, tossing us a like, subscribing to the channel, really growing the Fight Night Picks brand. And I do want to say thank you so much, because you guys have really done a great job. Next weekend, of course, you have the big time pay-per-view card, Charles Oliveira taking on Islam Makhachev in the main event. You have a big time main event after that one in a fight night with Arnold Allen and Calvin Kattar. Matt, MMA is really on the uptick right now.
It is, but for every uptick, you gotta go down. For every roller coaster, There's normally that, you know, slow rise.
And then the Apple Watches kind of go wild and they end up, like, calling the cops or something. That's what's going on with Apple Watches on Roller Coasters, the new series. But what we were...
What does that have to do with anything?
You're talking about roller coasters. What we do know about Roller Coaster Tycoon, and apparently neither one of us played it, is that at the top of the women's flyweight division, there's a little bit of a logjam. And if you look at it, Caitlin Chookagian's been around for a very long time, and it filters down from there. Even Jessica Andrade is ranked fourth in this weight class. Does she stick around at 125? Her last time out at 115, she finished Amanda Lemos. What we do know, though, is a fifth-ranked fighter in Grasso and the sixth-ranked fighter in Araujo can stake a claim to a title shot just being new blood for Valentina Shevchenko. And as a little bit of a nugget of a surprise, if you stuck around for this video, we have two content pieces coming out later on in the week. One centered around this main event, Shevchenko. One centered around Cub Swanson, Jonathan Martinez, and the co-main event that I think you're really going to enjoy. So keep your eye open for that. But again, Grasso wins, that's four in a row. Araujo wins, that's two in a row. It's just kind of an odd spot the division's at right now.
The flyweight division is probably the weakest right now of the three women's divisions. I think that's fair to say. Okay, featherweight fucking sucks, but that's because there's one fighter in it, so I feel easy saying
there's
that.
There's two. There's Norma Dumont and the champ.
My bad. Sorry, there's two fighters in a division. This is a weird fight, though, and I was really excited for the last main event that we got between Yan Xiaonan versus Mackenzie Dern, because that was a very similar fight. It was two fighters who, they might not be guaranteed a title shot after the fight's over, but you know something big is going to happen to them. With this fight, I don't really know, because for Araujo, even with a win over Grasso, who has looked really good as of late, I still feel like Viviani would need one more really big win after this to really stake her claim to be able to get in there with someone like Shevchenko. But for Grasso, I think four fights in a row probably would be good enough to get her in there. They've always wanted a Mexican star, if you will, to help get the UFC title. That was a big thing with like Yair Rodriguez for years before he had his issues, before he came back his last time against Brian Ortega. But I think this is an interesting fight, because Viviani Araujo has shown to be title caliber, I would say, at some points in her UFC tenure. But every time you really want to believe in her, that's when there's a dud of a performance, and she really just needs to have more of a steadiness throughout her MMA game. She has great kickboxing. She's a really good striker on the outside. We know how good her Muay Thai is. But she doesn't have the best pace to go along with her cardio, to go along with that striking. And that's that one area where if she could just refine her pace, that would really take her from just being like an all-star level player, if you will, and put her into that all-NBA MVP type conversation.
Like, if you really want to mix your martial arts and mix your sports, Viviani Araujo won the Pancrase title, comes into the UFC, and then went back to back to back like Tim Raines, Derek Jeter, and Paul O'Neill in the 1997 ALDS game one, if exactly. Baseball fans are hot on it, because she fought on back to back to back pay-per-view cards on the undercard, and she looked really, really successful. Now, did she end up losing to Jessica Ai? Yeah, she did.
Tough performance.
Then she won a couple more in a row. Montana De La Rosa, Roxanne Modafferi, looked very dominant. Loses to Caitlin Chookagian, that'll happen. And then her last time out beat Andrea Lee. But for Araujo, if I just painted you a picture and you just watch her UFC fights, you're going to go, okay, well, she'll mix in the takedown every now and again, but she's mainly a power puncher in this division. And I would say, yeah, like her fight against Talita Bernardo, yeah, she looks like a giant power puncher. She's actually a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt, and she really does have a good lineage of judo to back that up as well. It's just not that every fight, that's something you see out of Araujo.
You remember that song that was in like every NHL game? I know what I am, they know what they are, so let me be. Viviani doesn't know what she does well then, because that's the problem. I don't care if you have a black belt. I don't care how good you are at judo. If we never see you try to utilize those things in the cage against top-level oppositions, then I don't really care that you have the skill set. Because if Araujo goes out and beats Alexa Grasso, I don't think she's going to Damian Maya her, like, single-leg takedowns up against the cage, work her way to the back, and then utilize that as a submission. I think if anyone goes for a takedown, yes, she would be the more likely of the two. But that's really only because Alexa Grasso doesn't go for many takedowns whatsoever. And that's because her takedown defense struggles so mightily.
Usually, Alexa Grasso doesn't go for a lot of takedowns. In her last fight against Joanne Calderwood, she struggled with some of the pressure and the power out of Calderwood. Wood, no more Calder. We dropped the Wood. For Grasso, she ends up getting the fight down to the mat, submitting Joanne Wood for the first submission victory of her entire career. How wild was that?
If you're going to get your first submission victory of your career, you're probably going to do it against Joanne
Wood. Dr. Neville. So we'll see. Again, can Araujo's powerful style out of Cerrado MMA, her Julian Lane-esque style, translate to round 3, round 4, and round 5? Or Well, the more efficient volume striking out of Grasso win out as the fight progresses. That's really the big thing for me.
I don't see there being a lot of momentum swings in this fight. You know what I mean? Like, whoa. Whoever wins the first round is probably going to win the second, third, fourth, and fifth. Again, neither fighter has, I would say, top-tier finishing ability. Let's just call it what it is. Like, Araújo has good power, don't get me wrong, but she's in a division where we don't get a lot of stoppages. So even if you have one of them, we look at you like you're this thunderous power puncher. So, of course, Araújo probably has the higher potential to get a finish in this fight. But if Alexa Grasso is on her back foot, throwing with volume, doing that pitter-patter game and avoiding the big shots, that's not a style that can't be sustainable for 25 minutes. And if Araújo just gets into the face of Grasso, doesn't worry about the pitter-patter, and makes Grasso feel her physicality, that's also a style that's sustainable for 25 minutes. I really do think whoever wins the first round is just going to be able to maintain that game plan and rinse and repeat for the next four of them.
When we looked at last weekend, you drew the parallel. I mean, top rank women's strawweights. This weekend, top rank women's flyweights. Who's the more likely to finish? Last weekend, it was two weeks ago, it was definitely Mackenzie Dern over Yan Xiaonan.
For it all.
Yan Xiaonan was able to get it done. So do I again? I went with Yan Xiaonan. Do I go with the big underdog in this matchup? And now Araújo. Now the cat's out of the bag. She's a big underdog. Not necessarily. I don't look at it that way. I do look at Araújo similar to Dern, where Araújo, more methods of victory, more methods of finish, surely. I mean, you look at Grasso and you mentioned it. Takedown defense can be shoddy. It's 60% in the UFC. She's 6-3 in the UFC. Who did she struggle against? Well, Macy Barber
Felice
got three.
Felice Herrig she struggled with.
Macy Barber got three. I'm going backwards. Sorry. Carla Esparza got four. Tatiana Suarez got two and finished her. Felice Herrig got two and won by decision. Randa Marcos got four. So for Grasso, she struggles with the takedowns. She's been a favorite in every single UFC fight but one. The only one was the fight against Tatiana Suarez.
Where so she got rear naked choked in like 30 seconds.
It didn't go all that well for her. So for Viviane Araújo, all of those skills are there to get the finish. And you get her at an underdog price. The line opened -170 Grasso. It's -210 right now. For Araújo, open +145, +170. We have a look at the votes because we threw this one into the YouTube community tab. You folks voted 78% with Alexa Grasso, 22% with Araújo. Russ Gaudette is saying Alexa's going to keep it on the feet and get the win. Chad the OC Dad, we were watching Grasso in her prime. Going to be a fun fight. Grasso by decision. I mean, a decent call because Grasso is, of course, 29.
We're talking about Alexa Grasso like she's Jason Tatum, though.
You get Araújo at 35.
Watching her in her prime.
Will T saying, Nita, who cares button? And my response to that was Swanson Martinez with a bunch of fire emojis because there's that. Tommy saying, I think Vivi takes it. The Wretch saying, Grasso is good, but I don't see her beating Araújo. And then a couple more Araújos as well. So, Matt, the fans are kind of all over the place when they comment, but they're voting with Grasso. I want to hear from you down below in the comment section on this video. Let us know who you have. It really helps drive the traffic. A, and the Fight Night Picks community in general is great, but we really need to get a sense of who you have before we have question mark kicks 2 hours before the prelims this weekend. Matt, the final pick on this one, though, it could be tough. Who do you have?
I don't think there's going to be a stoppage in this fight, and for that reason, I do pick Alexa Grasso. I do think she is the steadier striker. I like her volume numbers, too. She does have really good technique off the back foot. Can strike moving forward and backwards. The thing about Araújo is, if she's not moving forwards, she can get stuck a little bit moving backwards to where she's not throwing at her most power. She's not throwing with a lot of volume, and I think that's the area where Grasso can have a lot of success. If she's making Araújo miss a lot early and then really making her pay with some of her counters, I think Alexa Grasso can have a nice looking performance. But the problem is, and this can be a problem for a lot of the fighters in this division until they do fight Valentina or at least start making like really competitive performances against her, even if you beat Viviani, it's probably not enough to get a title shot for me to really be convinced that you have a chance against Shevchenko. Like, unless you go out there and beat someone like a Tyler Santos and, like, finish her, that's okay. That would be the type of performance where now I'm convinced that you'd have a chance against Shevchenko. But I think Grasso could look really good in this fight, but I do think it's going to be hard to then leave this fight and think, wow, there's a compelling argument for her and Shevchenko.
For some reason in my mind's eye, I thought Araújo, and you had mentioned it, kind of just goes off a cliff round two, round three. There's certain fights where she's able to pick it up a little bit as the fight goes on. She tends to lose some of her second rounds. I go back to her fight against Alexis Davis. It was a main point in every single Alexis Davis video on this channel that I said, Alexis always wins the second round, usually loses the first. It depends on the swing round of a third. I thought Davis beat Araújo in that fight, or I thought it was at least very close and could have gone either way. Araújo ends up getting the win, but then I go through some of it. She gets beat with the volume numbers of Jessica Ai. She gets beat by the volume of Caitlin Chookagian on the back foot. She has a close fight against Andrea Lee where it's her takedowns and her submission attempts that win her the fight, but she did get dropped by Andrea Lee in that one. For me, I'll go with the volume numbers out of Grasso. Grasso has, in her own right, been able to pick it up as fights go on, kind of like Kamaru Usman's able to do in some of his fights, continue to stay hot round 3, 4, and 5. Obviously, big opportunity in the first 5-round fight for both these women in the UFC, but I'm ever so slightly going with Grasso. Don't really love a minus 200 line on her in this one because I think, again, Araújo has more methods of victory. Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt, Judo black belt as well, and if she can take it down to the mat, she can make it all kinds of uncomfortable for Grasso here.
I think she can, but again, I think Grasso's going to be able to keep it on the feet. Should be a fun fight for as long as it lasts, and I do expect it to last the full 25 minutes, but I got Grasso.
If you like April Wines harder, faster, let us know down below in the comment section. We made that reference in the last fight. We have question mark kicks 2 hours before the prelims, Matt. What does that entail on Saturday?
It's just a chance for us to look at the weigh-ins, give our last prediction on any fights in case we did change our mind throughout the week. Maybe watch a little bit more tape. Maybe we saw something in the media we didn't like. For any other reason under the sun, it just gives us a chance to go back through the fights and talk to you guys one last time.
Let us know what you like, what you didn't like. Make sure that you comment down below. A like on this video is definitely appreciated. And if you are so inclined, subscribe. Big things coming and throughout this fight week. A special encore of Valentina Shevchenko video with these two involved. That's coming out this week. A Cub Swanson and Jonathan Martinez video coming out. That will be there as well. A big week for Fight Night Picks with content that you've never seen before from the channel. Just keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.